Hello and welcome to Unidentified Wargamer. Each week I interview a wargamer and identify them in the hobby. We've got a special episode this week. Corey Papapanini and I are talking about the lists and players for the Australian Masters that's happening this weekend. How are you going, Corey?
Yeah, really well. Thanks so much for having me on. I'm very excited to talk about what's happening in the Masters arena. Yeah, very excited.
Corey loves getting deep and dirty with these things.
Yeah, absolutely. I've had a lot of people message me like, don't tell them all the tech.
It's because Corey knows it all.
I try my best to keep up to it, but there's just so much going on all the time. I mean, with the battle time coming out every 2 weeks, it's a bit ridiculous, but you know, you do your best.
Yeah. Yeah. You might hear a bit of paper moving around and things like that. We're trying to make it as straightforward and as easy as listening to as possible. But it's going to be a bit of rustling and stuff like that. But we're just going to go over the names, players, and notable mentions. So we'll get started here first anyway. But we've got 16 players playing on the, is it the 22nd of April? Yeah, 22nd of April weekend for the Australian Masters at Irresistible Force Logan. After the drops and people unable to make it, we've landed in the top 25 people, minus 9 have made it in. So just going down the list here of people that have come into the weekend. So we've got Joel Graham, Dave Kerr, Pat Nevin, Wayne Buck, Alexander Cron, Joel McGrath, Bob Van Emmerich, Terence Voller, Jacob Strasham, Jared Baker, Michael Clark, Nathan Thompson, Scott Wyatt, Matt Terrell, Karen Coates, and Sam Sims. And they range from first place being Joel all the way down to 25th place being Karen Coates. So we've got a wide array of scores and player skill here, but obviously the best 25 players in Australia. I've also worked out how many people are from like what region. There's a few lackluster ones here being Queensland and South Australia. There's only two of us, well, from each one. poor showing.
I have to admit, like, Gabe gave me a bit of a rouse. It's like, mate, I've done all this effort to make Masters in Queensland and you're not even going.
We got 5 Victoria players and 7 from New South Wales to top out the 16. So great. New South Wales is doing very strong in the AOS scene. I've also recorded, so score-wise, we've got Joel at number 1 with a perfect score of 300. Well, he got 7 perfect scores of 100. And then Karen down at 262 for his results there. And then we've got Jacob pulling out 13 events registered for the tournament and Sam getting in with 3. So Sam's done really well to get in with 3. Most people sort of average between 9 and 6. And the tournaments that were registered as well, it goes from April 1st of 2021 to the end of March 2023. So it's pretty long sort of season for us. I think the delays with COVID and we bumped it out another year because of a few issues have extended it to, I think there's something like 50 or 60 tournaments that were registered because there's quite a few one days in there as well for a few scores. That's the main players. We have two. I wanted to give 2 notable mentions. There was 2 players in the top 10 who actually weren't able to make it. So we've got Corey here himself. He's not able to make it. He came in 4th. And also Ash McEwen from Sydney came in 8th. So neither of them for the top 10 are making it. So that's bumped out a few more people in. There's a few others there, 5 others, but there's too many names to sort of go through in the podcast or go for too long. Did you have anything you wanted to speak about before we get started into sort of just going over some basic player information there, Corey?
It's important to be aware with this one is that I know there's some people out there that like typically talk about, if it's not really the top 16 players, then really like how viable is it? You have to remember that all these players have been to multiple events, have all placed really well and have done, fantastic at events and placed and so being such a long season, I think it's a really good point that a lot of the data that comes through from then and the consistency of all the players that have come through, I think there's no player amongst the 16 that really shouldn't be there, if that makes sense. So regardless of where people were on the ladder and such, all these players are highly skilled. You regularly see them doing well at the local events or when they travel. I'm not too across if all of the players had traveled interstate or not, like, but regardless, there's no one here that's out of place. Like, I know most of these names and they've all done well and we've heard their names spoken about before. So fantastic effort to everyone to make the top 16 into Masters.
Oh, and then even with Sam being the minimum of three tournaments to get to, so obviously Sam's a strong player to be able to get into with three games, like three tournaments under his belt. So that was like the minimum amount, and he scored highly there. So like a lot of these people have played in five, six, seven, eight tournaments. So they've shown that they're able to pip out because it's based off your top three results. So there's clear skill there and talent being able to have three results that equal to get you into the top 25 essentially out of I think it's about 300 or so people. There was one notable mention I want to put out there. I was looking for myself through the list and I came out at number 69.
Ah, well done, well
So
done.
gotta love that. Gotta love that. So that's the main brief there for all the players. I wrote down a bunch of notes before finding out that the software that I was reading off of was slightly a little bit skewed. So I've tried to amend them as best as possible, but there might be a few mistakes in here. And then everything we say as well is all in jest and all good nature. We're not here to bag out people. So if you do feel a little bit hurt from us speaking about your list and things like that, we don't mean it unintentionally. We're just trying to look at it from more of an objective view. So we've got Joel Graham here, came in at number one. He got seven perfect 300s. There might be a few more because the event thing I was missing, but he got eight firsts and two thirds. His two thirds were 5-0s, one being CanCon, and I'm not sure, I haven't written the other one down, but yeah, so he got pretty much nearly a flawless record all season. On the software I was able to look at, his only one loss was to Ash McEwan. So he done really well there. I'm not sure on the other few events if he got any losses, but I think he pretty much nearly had a flawless season.
No, as far as I know, he's pretty much a flawless season. I mean, Joel Graham is a name that everyone's heard of and spoken about at length in the Australian community and even internationally. He was, I think, I'm not sure if he was the first Australian player, but he's certainly a notable Australian player that even like the stats wise over at Honest Wargamer, he was like the one and only Australian that was actually listed on there just because of how successful he was in the Australian meta. I mean, he's a fantastic player. I mean, he just every event he goes to, he dominates. Yeah, he's no dark horse, and he's certainly a favorite to take out the whole event.
He's been dominating since his very first tournament.
I know. The man is a machine.
Yes, indeed. And then a lot of these people as well, just if you're new to the podcast, I have interviewed a lot of these people here. So if you do want to hear their backstory, a bit of information about them, especially like Joel was on there as well. So that's why we have a little bit more information there. Give it a listen. There's about 50 something episodes to make your way through. Corey's on there too.
Yeah, don't waste your
And then next up, we've got Dave Kerr from Queensland, first representative for us Queenslanders here.
time.
Dave went to 10 events and he pulled out five firsts, 2 seconds, and an eighth. I think there's a few more in there, but I couldn't pull them up. And he's gone quite well over the season as well. He pipped a score of 298, so just shy of the perfect 300. He's played a few 1 days as well, pulling out the 3-0s. He even took Crew Boys to a 4-1 at Goldcon.
What a
So he's
man.
pulled out. Yeah.
What a man.
Those Crew Boys and those low results. I did just realize I have another one other stat. I've also put in how many different armies people have played. So Joel Graham played seven different armies as well over the season. So he's pulled out a
Absolutely
few there.
ridiculous.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
We've got three different armies for Dave. That's all we've got for Dave.
Brilliant. I mean, Dave's another notable name, just like Joel. He's a previous two-time master. He's been playing since the inception of AOS, as far as like the competitive scene goes, and has continually gone on to define meta-defining lists as well as local and Australian level meta. He's noted in the international level, just like Joel is. Like he's a fantastic player. I've had the pleasure of playing against him multiple times, and he's always one to make you think and consider all the options. And yeah, again, a notable player who is a favorite to potentially see him in the final as well. So go Queensland.
He's a bit of my nemesis as well. He seems to pit me at the very end of the tournament and keeps knocking me out.
As far as players go, like I can't speak to Joel's as a player too much because I've never had the pleasure of playing him. But Dave's a great player in the sense that he's always looking for his list. He's never one to take the meta list. He's always one to consider, okay, if this is what the package is typically for the meta, how are people like trying to build and tailor towards beating those meta lists? And then how can I take that package and then counter the counter that's bringing to me. So he always tends to bring his nice little 250 or 300 points worth in a list, his own version of that. And we'll see an example of that in his list later.
Up third, we've got Pat Nevin from Victoria. Oh, sorry, Joel is from New South Wales. I believe he's been in Bathurst. He's been all over New South Wales, I'm pretty sure. we've got Pat Nevin from Victoria. Pat's been to 10 events. He's pulled out a first and two thirds. And his one first was from the Lost Legion GT, and he played Ogres. So I know, speaking to Pat on the podcast and speaking to Pat in person, he's a rampant Korn and Ogre lover. So it's nice for him to pull out his first with that. And he came within a score of 296. So he's done quite well there for himself.
Yeah, so Pat is a fantastic player. I unfortunately have never had the pleasure of playing against him, but he's a fellow Korn man. I can't say too much because I'm a bit of a tourist compared to him. He's played Korn for a lot longer than I have. But he's a fantastic player. A lot of his success has contributed to obviously the Iron Blaster lists and him doing well at that particular event as well as some other events. So great to see that he's there and doing well. I mean, the 291 points is a fantastic result. And I'm interested to dive into his list a bit with the Nurgle pick. I know he was running Nurgle for a little while with some flies and some other bits and pieces, but he's taken something a bit unique, which I quite like. So yeah, great to see Pat up there. Fantastic effort, mate.
Yeah. And then up on fifth, so fourth was Corey. Fifth is Alexander Kron, Mr. KO Admiral himself. Alexander Kron's played quite a few tournaments. He's playing 11 tournaments. He's pulled out one first and 3 seconds. The first, I believe, was with a Zench list, and the two of the 3 seconds were also with Zench. So he's pulled out a lot more wins with the Zench than he has KO, but he's known for his KO armies. And he's played 3 armies over the season as well. I think one of them was also Daughters of Cain. So Kron was fifth.
Yeah, Alexander Kron, unfortunately, so many great players I've never had the chance to really like play against. It just shows me that like I need to get more, get out there and start playing some more people. So Alexander Kron, obviously notable for being such a powerful and strong KO player. But obviously picking up Zench and Daughters of Cain, I think from the Masters, the Worlds, time that he was with the Masters team last year, to do so well with Zench. Zench is a strong army and a strong list. So a great demonstration of his flexibility to pivot off his main staple army and still be able to do extremely well with another army like that. So fantastic effort.
And then Kron's from South Australia as well. Got to add these bits in there to flavor it up for people. And then next up, we've got Wayne Buck. So Wayne has put out quite a few events. He's got 9 events there. He's played, I'm pretty sure it's all with Skaven. He seems to be a Skaven connoisseur. He's pulled out a first. Oh, sorry, no. Actually, he did play one with Nurgle and got the first at Royal Rampage. But his other few results have all pretty much been Skaven. He's pulled out 2 seconds and 1/3 as well. And Wayne's from South Australia as well. So I have not met Wayne, but I have seen his name float around a few times.
Yeah, me as well. I know of Wayne as a very strong Skaven player, and looking through his list, he's got some great options and some fantastic tech pieces. So I'm very excited to see how well he does. I know there's like a bit of a solitary like meta in South Australia. It's hard to get out to some of the other states being so expensive and stuff. So I'd be really interested to see how he does against some of the other players, the notable players that we see regularly through the series. So that'd be great.
Mm, indeed. And then we've got the mayor himself, Matt Turrell, coming up at number 7 here. Matt Turrell is from New South Wales, and he's been to 4 events. His main pull has been Nighthaunt, but he's been sort of all over the place with event results with certain armies, but he's pulled out a solid 284 points as well.
So I'm a huge fan of Matt. I've got the pleasure of playing him at CanCon. And the fact that he is so dedicated to the faction of Death and to do so well with, like, a Grand Alliance that typically people would consider as, like, the lowest of the four. To do so well so consistently across multiple armies. He's a fantastic player, previous Masters winner as well, former captain of the Australian team for 2022. Like, the man, again, is just one of those notable players that has so many reps under such a consistent and strong army, such like Nighthaunt, that he's a considerable threat for anyone in the list, so I'm looking forward to seeing how well he does. I have a feeling he's going to do quite well.
Oh, yes. Number 8 was Ash McEwen, who's not able to make it. And then number 9, Scott Wyatt himself from Queensland. We all know about Scott. Scott's been on, he's everywhere. He sort of seems to whore ourselves out everywhere. Scott's been to 11 events, pulled out 283 tournament points, and I think he's played three different armies over the season as well.
Yeah, most notably for his cinch. Congratulations to him for making the Australian team for 2023 recently. So fantastic effort there, mate. Well deserved. Yeah, and I mean, just like you were saying, Scott's been to like many, many events. He runs a store. The man lives and breathes Warhammer. So, I mean, he's our local rules lawyer. Anytime I have a question, I always like hit him up and he knows the answer. So he's a man that's very educated and is aware of the game and the systems and gets regular reps. I mean, the man's playing games every day. So he's a consistent placer, very well and strong operator as far as like knowing the rules. And a big part of AOS, as we all know, is that the more information you know, the better decision making you can do. So he's a man that's well equipped in that area. So I'm keen to see him do well, especially with the Zinch list he's been running regularly for the last few events.
Yeah, wish Scott the best as our local carrier for us down here at Gold Coast in Brisbane. And then at number 10, we've got Joel McGrath. Everyone loves a good Joel. And there's two of them at the event. So Joel's from Victoria, also been on the podcast. He went 8 events, but he seems to be struggling. He keeps getting stuck at third place. He's got 4 thirds. Yeah, I don't think I've never seen him at a second or a first. He's not even the bride. He's like the bridesmaid's bridesmaid, whatever they're called.
They're party words, mate. Be careful. You might start a third podcast war between the three.
And he's known most notable for his Mr. Whippy list, which is where he's pulled out, I think, three or four of those thirds from.
Yeah, which is such a fantastic list. I've actually proxied that list a few times just out of curiosity to see what it can do. And it's a fantastic innovation and idea. I'm not sure if he came up with that on himself, but I haven't seen an inclination or a version of it before seeing it from him. So fantastic effort for coming up with. I really like when people come up with an innovative idea or not a meta-defining list, but something unique that works really well and transfers itself into the meta. So fantastic effort there. But obviously also a well-known Bok player. I'm looking forward to diving into his list again later on. There's some sweet tech inside there. And again, a man that has not taken the meta shift like that most people did with their bull gores and things like that. He went a different direction. And notably now, the meta is going in that same direction as well. So great to see him thinking outside the box and going where he thinks the strength in the book is, which is the type of player he's in. He is.
Oh, yes, definitely. And then we've got Michael Clark, who I spoke to last week. Brilliant batsman and brilliant AOS player. Michael Clark's from Victoria. He's been to 8 events, came in 12th, and then with a score of 281. So solid result there from him.
Yeah, Clark is another guy I regularly speak with. I've had the distinct pleasure of playing him now twice, and a fantastic opponent. Very, very friendly. And just, again, a really strong and knowledgeable person who takes the time to go beyond just understanding the rules and concepts of the game and defining strategies and such and tactics, but also taking the time to really understand how matchups work. And he's a fantastic asset, I know, to the Australian team and the information he brings. Again, a really considered player, especially when you look at his list that we'll talk about later. He's someone that's, yeah, he considers all the options and the angles and makes decision-making to best put him in the best position. So aside from like taking a very strong list, he's actually looked at players that are going to be there, the players pack and things like that. And he's decided on a particular list to perform a specific job and a perfect reminiscence of what type of player he is. So I'm keen to see how his very niche list and approach will do in this event.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he's a brilliant batsman, that's for sure. We've got Nathan Thompson up next. Unfortunately, he's got the wrong last name. He's got a P in his Thompson, so he's automatically out. Nathan's been to 9 events. He's from Victoria, and he's pulled out a score of 274 and coming in at 15th.
I've not met Nathan, but I've heard many, many good things, obviously, and he's taken a very, very strong list. Like, I love Fire Slayers. I mean, I do and I don't, like everyone else. Like, they all look the same, but man, oh man, are they good in this GHP? And oh my goodness, the list is very, very strong. I'm very excited to talk about his list and see how he does moving forward.
We've got a brilliantly named person here. We've got Sam Sims coming in with a minimum result of 3 events. He's coming at 16th. He's from Victoria. He's coming with a score of 274 from 3 events. So it's a solid result from him.
Yeah, I mean, kudos to him for having such only like three events underneath his belt after such a long period of time to be able to put in such strong results with the army that he's chosen to do that with is fantastic. Sam's notably as a strong Zinch player in the past. I've had again the pleasure of playing him when I went down to FIC GT. Very strong player, very across it. Interesting list this time around. I'm not personally too aware of the Sylvaneth thing, and I know a lot of people are kind of sleeping on the potential that Sylvaneth brings to the table, especially in this sort of pack in this sort of situation. So keen to deep dive his list later on and see how well he does.
Up next, we've got Bob Van Emmerich, Mr. Soulblight himself. So Bob's been to four events, all with Soulblight, and he's pulled out a third with his Soulblight as well. Bob's from New South Wales, and he came in with a score of 273 for 18th.
Bob was my first game at CanCon, and
Was
he's one of
he?
those guys. Yeah, he was. And I had no idea who he was. And I was talking to people, who's this Bob guy? And everyone's like, oh, he's really good. Everyone I spoke to was like, oh, yeah, Bob's real good. And he got to the table. And you know, when you meet someone, and he's just such a friendly guy, and just not one of those guys that like hides his tech or anything. He's just like, oh, this is what this does, and this is what this does. He's just really open and a lovely player experience. I mean, to play, like, typically, not typically, sometimes you play against opponents at a certain level, and they do certain things, and they fudge sort of movements and things like that. But he was straight ace, straight laced, great opponent to play. And again, another opponent that's really across his army with lots and lots of reps in. Right, the man knows Soulblight inside and out, and he's got a very great list. So again, fantastic list, and I'm keen to dive into that and see how he does.
And at number 20th, we got Terence Voller. From reading briefly on all the events he went to, he is a avid Sons of Bermat player. I think four of the five events he went to were Sons. He's played five events, came in with a score of 271, and he's also from New South Wales, which there's seven of you, so there's lots of you.
So Terence is one of the few people I don't know too much about or heard too much about. But what I have heard, he's a disciple of Joel Graham, I should say, an avid player of the game in the sense that he's one of those guys that like really digs in and gets lots and lots of reps in to best understand the game. He's got a very strong list with a very keen focus on his win condition. Yeah, I'm keen to see, like, it's so interesting when you see these players at this level and not being too across like how what sort of player they are and how they approach their game. And so I'm very interested to see how it all turns out for him.
Coming in number 22, we've got Jacob Strachan. I don't know if it's a ch or sh. We'll find out. He came in with 13 events, so he was one of the highest tournament attendees th for this season with 13. He's from New South Wales as well and came in with 267 for his score.
Again, Jacob's just one of those names that I haven't heard too much about or had the pleasure of meeting. He's bringing a very strong list, with Lumineth, and we'll talk about that later with some interesting options and pivot points. But I'm keen to see how he goes. Again, these names where you don't hear them very regularly, I'm very keen to see what they can bring and their approach to the game. Very excited to see how they go.
He's just bringing up, just because we weren't sure what sort of lists he's played previously, he's an avid Zench player and he's also played quite a lot of Lumineth as well. It's only Zench and Lumineth, a little bit of Magicken. So clearly he's bringing a list that he knows quite well in terms of how it all works for him. So number 23rd, we've got Jared Baker. I spoke to Jared the other week. Lovely fella, and I love playing against him. So Jared went to 10 events. He's from New South Wales. And came with a score of 264.
Yeah, Jared Baker with the Daughters of Cain, very, very strong list. Keen to get in and talk about that and how his approach to the game and like how his list settles into the meta, the very like very small sample size of meta that we're going to be engaging with this pack. So yeah, very keen to see how well he does.
And then finally, at the end here, we've got Kieran Coates. Came in at 25th, from New South Wales. He's been to 10 events, and the score of 262. So only a difference between the two people from first and 25th of 38. So, I mean, there's not much of a difference in there at all.
So Kieran Coates is a known quantity down in Victoria. I know. I'm pretty sure he ran one of the GTs or the major events that happened there recently, and I heard was a sound event. An avid player. I know he plays a bit of Nighthaunt, a bit of Skaven. So I'm very excited to see. I love some of the tech pieces he's brought specifically for his list as well. So keen to get into that.
And that sort of concludes all 16 of the players for the Masters event here. So we've got sort of tried to give a bit of flavor and a bit of info for people. So after this, we'll get cracking and we'll get nice and deep on these lists here and also sort of go over the matchups and sort of give a brief explanation of who we sort of think is going to win out of the first matchups here, because we can actually see who's playing who because of the seeded tournament. So if you're not sure what seeded is, it's pretty much the person who came first in the season will be playing the lowest scoring player. So we've got Joel coming up against Kieran. The idea behind that is to make it so the top players of the season will most likely be vying it out at the end of the tournament rather than knocking themselves out early.
Yeah, you see this sort of placement and this idea of like an MMR system in a lot of other systems, whether it be chess, video games, street, like, you know, fighting games, a whole bunch of other professional avenues that people are engaging with all the time. So I think it's a great idea to bring in. And it's something I would even not strongly urge, but consider for other events potentially with an ongoing MMR system. But that's just, that may perhaps put too much work and too much, you know, spikiness just coming out of me. But yeah, it's a fantastic system. I think it's great to include. And I love the idea of the single knockout elimination style. This is
it's cool. It's perfect for the low amount of players as well. So then it makes it real easy to see because they're already, everything's imported. Like we know exactly what their MMR is for the whole season. So it makes it really nice and simple.
And also means that like all the effort that Joel, for instance, has put into by going to all these events and being so successful, it actually gives him something tangible that he can put into the matching pair system that he gets out of it, rather than like, let's say, for instance, he gets paired into another very strong player in round one compared to someone like Sam, who kind of not get him by his knee here, but only did three events, comes in and then he gets not quote unquote the bunny run or the easier run side of things, et cetera, et cetera. You know what I mean? So it's a great system to kind of even out that playing field of those people who's really invested in and have done being very successful to get something out of it worthwhile for this pairing system. I think it's great.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It works really well and really rewards effort.
Yeah.
So this is the main segment, or this is the starting segment for all the players. So we're going to crack on now. Do you have any info or tidbits before we start off here in terms of with the tournament? I know we just spoke about seeding, but was there anything else that you wanted to speak about here?
Yeah, so it's an interesting pack and the idea around the list creation and generation period of time, because there's three kind of caveats that I think are important for our listeners to be aware of. And number one would be that lists were due before missions were made public. So during the time where players were submitting their lists, they had no idea what missions they were preparing for. Obviously, it's a four-round event, so four missions are coming through, and they have since been made aware. But when they submitted their list, they had no idea. So they had to consider those options. So things like the newest missions, for instance, if you didn't include or had a large proportion of GCs in your list, you're really putting yourself at a potential disadvantage with some of these missions, such as Take What's Theirs, where a GC can hold an objective regardless of how many models are on there, as well as extra scoring on some missions. It puts the players in a position where they have to consider that very large thing. So some armies don't have the ability to flex into those GCs, as we all know. So I won't labor the point, but it's something to be very aware of going into this with their list submissions. Number two is that they're working within a very isolated meta. So the pack says no FAQ, no play, which I'm a huge fan of. I know that GW is a little bit slow to release their FAQs recently, meaning that people often are a bit sad that they don't get to play with their toys. But this way we remove all the ambiguity. So things like the latest KO, Khorne, Slaanesh, OBR, Soulblight book are not in play. But the battle scroll updates with points and, of course, the big change to the rally rule are in play. So they're in this very isolated situation with the meta. So things like Luminef, Zench, Beast of Chaos, and Gitz, of course, are the ones that are doing extremely well win rate-wise at this time, considering these books aren't coming in. So when they submit these lists, they know that they don't have to worry about the ridiculous output KO. They know they don't have to worry about 40 to 50 bliss barbs shooting them off with a one drop. They know they don't have to deal with the rigidity of OBR and the defensive layers that they can push out. So they don't have to factor those things in. They just have to consider what other threats they have to consider. So that's another component, as well as the rally change. And the third caveat would that be in, when you typically go to events, like a two-day event with like 80 plus players or so, obviously the goal for a lot of competitive players is to push for a podium finish, whether it be first, second, or third, or, you know, to get up there as high as you can with the 4-1 and in potential 5-0. But things to consider would be like, typically people's approaches would be to be pushing for lean towards more aggressive option. That way, when you win convincingly and you get your 20-0 sort of scoring, depending on the pack, of course. But with this pack, with Masters being a four round elimination style, coming down to just two players, there will only be one 4-0. And regardless of kind of like the secondary stuff, there is going to be the idea is that there is will be one player who wins it all. What this means is that with list submission and strategy specifically, is that all strategies should be viable in the sense that control lists or parking lot lists or bunker alphas, all these types of ideas that typically will win by only a few points by grinding out those wins through attrition and control, they are viable strategies because you only need to win your game by like 1 point and then you move on as a winner to potentially take the gold, which should be the goal for all 16 players, which I'm sure it is. So what this means is it opens up the viability of so many different strategies and tactics that you may be a bit more reserved when it comes to a traditional 2-day event, which is fantastic. It means all play, all ideas, all concepts are open and valid, which is very exciting. And we see some of this in the list submissions, which is fantastic.
Just an example for some people as well who aren't quite aware. So there was for a while there, the Legion of the First Prince list was a heavy control list that seemed to have taken out a lot of sort of lower placings in tournaments. They always would be like a 4-1 or maybe a 5-0, but they'd always be at the very bottom because they couldn't score very much. So that's just sort of like one example of a heavy control list that sort of rewarded you being able to get enough points to get the win, but not enough to get a solid placing off of that.
Yeah, exactly. When you compare that to something like Doors of Cain with, Marathi and the Bosnex, they're just literally just trying to shoot you off the table, or something like Seraphon, where they're just efficiently trading out, like things like that, that are, they're going to win very convincingly, or they're going to lose, as compared to something like a control that, irks out the win. Yeah, exactly.
So we'll pop on here. So for our first matchup of the weekend, we've got Joel Graham and Kieran Coates. So we've got Kieran Coates is playing Skaven, and then Joel's got Gloomspite Gits. What do you think of that matchup for the first round there?
I mean, at this time, at this venture, Gits are just so incredibly strong and potent. And the list that Joel Graham has brought post Battle Scroll again is so incredibly strong. And the synergies that are overlapping and enabling all their strong hammers and the recycling and even the Battle Shock. I mean, not the Battle Shock, sorry, the help me out, the revival mechanic. Rally, rally, even with the rally changes. Yeah, all these factors have been taken into place. And I think Joel is sitting on a really incredibly strong list. Not to say that Kieran's list doesn't have its own flavor and its own tech. If I had to put someone ahead, just looking at lists specifically, regardless of player strength, I think the Gits is just one of those incredibly strong S tier level armies at this point, looking at this particular meta. And I'd put the favor going towards the Gits. Would you agree?
Yes, so I don't think the Skaven has enough output. Like, I know he's got Thankful there, but with the 5-up ward and the 2 wounds each on all the squig stuff, like the warp 5 projectors can't do enough damage. So I don't think there's enough damage coming out of the Skaven list to even deal with the Gits list and their recursion with Rally and the Loon Shrine.
Yeah, I have to agree. So, shall we have a look?
We'll have a look. We'll deep dive these two fine gentlemen.
All right. Which list would you like to start with?
Let's go with the Skaven list because I think it's maybe a bit more easier to pass because people know it's a known quantity because it's been out for over a year now.
Look, to be honest, it is a known quantity as far as like it's been out for a while, but still get my head around some of the statement jacks. Yeah.
So we've got Skaven. Mortal Realm doesn't matter at all. Grand strategy of take what's theirs and the triumph of inspired.
Yeah, so this obviously points us into the idea that taking what's theirs means that he's going to be moving away from like a castle strategy and typically moving towards more of aggressive idea, which we do see a lot out of more combat orientated Skaven picks. Yeah, especially when you look at like things like the Vermilord Warbringer with the Devious Adversary and Rust Cursed armor, which gives him the +1 save as well as the extra attacks.
And then you've got Flaming Weapon as well for more damage.
Yeah, exactly. So he's like this massive beat stick support piece with his buff. Oh, no, I shouldn't say support. He's more of like a beat stick with buffs.
Well, and then you can see as well, he's got Skill Leap on two of his heroes, and he's got a Warp Grinder. So he's doing a lot of movement. He even got Louch on as well. So even more movements to get up into the face of the enemy there and try and probably bog him down a little bit with those Clan Rats and Sensor Bearers.
Yeah, and so looking at the list, you can kind of deconstruct it in a sense that he understands that when he submitted the list, he knew that Gits were going to be a problem. So Thankful Four War Projectors is a great anti-horde pick, as well as the Hellpit Abomination because of the mortal wounds it does on the charge with rerolls. So with that, so Thankful combined with the Lauchon is like a known quantity and something to be worried about as far as hordes go. And I love the idea of having these two gray seers. This enables him to have the Master Clan trap for three claw steps ahead, which is a great delivery mechanism for his 10 plague sensor bearers, which I dare say will go in the ground with his war grinder. What essentially means is that he can roll a die. Like, for instance, he gets the charge phase that came up. They need a 9-inch charge, right? So obviously he pitches the first charge roll. Doesn't have to be the plague sensor bearer. It's just something else. And if he hits a nice high charge roll, he can factor that in for all his other units. And what this means is it gives his sensor bearer just more opportunities to get in looking for that 9-inch charge, which I know you're a fan of being a Skaven player.
Yes. Yeah, this is how I played the army, was very, very close to this, was the three claw steps. But back then you could also use the Packmaster with the giant rats to get a bonus to that, which for some reason they removed it from some armies and not other armies with big bonuses to charge. Who knows why they did that?
Yeah, it seemed a bit silly, didn't it?
Yeah. So he's got the three endless spells as well. So he's got the Warp-Binding Vortex and Vermintide. I've not seen a whole lot of Vermintide on the board, but he's got a lot of endless spells and a lot of points wrapped up on those endless spells.
I love the inclusion of the Vermintide. It's like a 40-point cheeky endless spell that's easy to cast, which is a good thing and a bad thing, because what he wants to do with it, I imagine, is to threaten opponents with its long, long range. It has a really strong effective range, but also has a massive base. So it's a great base blocker. And when your opponent gets within 3 inches after a charge, it's proccing mortals. When they move towards it's proccing mortals. When it moves, it procs mortals. Like, it's kind of like that that Lumineth spell, right? The Rune of Petrifaction or whatever it's called.
Or if even the oh, now I'm blanking on it. The Gits one. Scuttle Tide.
Yeah, perfect. That's exactly what it is. It's just there, 40 points. You got all these casts with these gray skiers. And I love the inclusion of these as well, because you obviously want those GCs with the movement that he has with Skittle Leap. So I just love the inclusion of that. Warp-Lining Vortex is a no quantity, very strong through the little techie, you know, through the, you Skittle Leap, you cast it out, and then you go back through the hole. That sort of stuff is great. But I also found it very interesting that he and some other people have gone for the aspect of the champion leadership of the Alpha. And what this means is that instead of going for the Tunnel Master, they're electing to have this kind of strong go turn where they can pick up to 3 units for +1 to hit or +1 save or 3 redeploys and things like that. I love the flexibility of this. He doesn't need the Tunnel Master with the Skitter Leap and the use of the gnaw holes and such. So I think it's a great pick, and it pricks the mind towards, like, okay, he's probably trying to set up this idea of this Hell Pit, 10 Plague Sensor Bearers, and maybe this Verminlord Warbringer, like, triple strong go turn once he opens up the screens and such. And, like, we can't go beyond saying, like, we can't go past without mentioning the double Death Frenzy fight on death. You know what I mean? So with those, even those 20 clan rats, I was looking through his list and thinking, like, how is he going to remove screens? But 20 clan rats with double fight on death, two attacks each, you get them on threes and threes, like that's a lot of 60 attacks before they disappear. Like, they will clear screens, they will trade those things out, which I think he's looking to do.
And they're so cheap as well, like 100 points min battle line, 3 blocks of 20, like there's not worth any value whatsoever to you, but they can pump out enough to clear those screens, like you were saying. And it gives you that viable way to bust open the castle without spending all the points on some of the stuff that you don't want to spend points on.
Yeah. That plus all the mortal wounds from there and the spells, some of the shooting, like I think it's really solid. He's a 2-drop and 134 wounds. So the wound average would be around the 100 mark, I'd say, maybe the 90 mark. So you're high on the wounds, high model count, 2 drops, which is great. I mean, you won't be vying for that turn priority with those like battle regiment lists that we'll look at later, but 2 drops is respectable. 1990 means he probably won't be hitting that Inspired Triumph, but you know, it's still there as something that potentially hit on a 1995 or over. So yeah, strong list. I think it's very clear what his win condition is. He's got some great mechanisms and things like that. So I think he'll be one of those lists that's looking to control the double, which is why he's gone so low drop, because he doesn't want to. I think concern would be people being able to break through those 20 clan rats in a turn and then go into his juicy pieces straight after. He does have the null deploy for the sensor bearers, but again, you have to consider those really important pieces like Thankwell like the Warbringer, et cetera.
What's handy is we can also look at who he's versing up straight away. And Joel's also a two drop. So
yeah,
round one's going to be a roll off to who gets to decide what happens there.
Yeah, interesting. And we do know the missions as well. And the first mission is the Jaws of Galette. Yeah. So Jaws of Galette is I wouldn't say it's an L shape, but it's kind of like a corner deployment with some things coming outwards with five objectives, with one of them disappearing. So it doesn't force, but it enables people to kind of spread out to max score. They're not funneling into a single point. So I think having something like Skaven, where the mobility and multiple units, it can be very handy for that event, for that mission.
And then before we forget, all the lists are posted online already on the Australian Masters Facebook page. I will put links to it all so you can read through and have a look at it exactly. We don't want to sort of read straight down the list word for word what's on the list. We're sort of trying to pass through and pull out those juicy bits of information, because we all know how boring just a straight down the list, a list review show of like those are.
Absolutely.
And then Kerrion's versing Joel. Joel's got Gitz, Jaws of Mork, Take What's Theirs, and Indomitable Triumph.
Yep, and sitting at 1975, so a solid bid for the Triumph. So he'll be getting the Triumph in that matchup. Again, like you said, two drops, but 182 wounds. Oh my gosh. I think that's the highest wound count in the event, actually.
Wouldn't surprise me. And then with the recursion as well, there's just even more and more wounds.
Exactly. And like we were saying before, just utilizing those wound counts on the table. I know they're not the best like quality runes with fives and six up saves and low bravery, but it's definitely a factor to consider in this particular pack. If he really needed to, he could lean into that side of the list and just push them forward and keep, you know, flooding those objectives. But thankfully, he doesn't need to, because he has plenty of output, doesn't he?
Oh, yes. All the output. And he's also got a five-up ward where he needs it as well.
Yeah. It's just like, it's just so strong how amazing. Like what I see this army as is almost like, you know, like a Seraphon of old, where you could juice up, you take your blank canvas, like your skinks, right? And you just juice them up with all these different buffs and overlays, and you just send them through and they out trade and just outperform their points cost. That's kind of how this army kind of works, I feel, with the three pieces being the hoppers, the herd, and the foreign grot bounders. Like there's just the overlapping layers of extra rend, extra attacks, you know, mortal wounds on sixes. It's just fantastic.
And now all the buffs work on all three of those units, whereas it used to be very locked to keywords. So now if one of the units dies, I'll just go on to the next one and buff that one up and send it off, or the next one, or even themselves, because they're all the buff pieces are somewhat usable in combat as well.
Some shout outs as far as like really nice defining pieces in here. I really love the inclusion of the spore splatters for that flexibility of being able to deny line of sight for shooting, but also to have them inside a piece to give them extra attacks. I think that's fantastic and very flexible. My favorite part is probably the moon face Mommet combination with the madcap shaman and the hand of cork, but particularly the tunnel master. So for instance, if he plays, you know, deploys outside of 30, he can get the hand of gork, only has to be within 12 to reduce the save, but the tunnel master means it's not a guarantee, but it's, he can lean back into that redundancy. If he needs to, which is fantastic, because he just point click reduce save, which is really, really strong. And then the other thing was obviously the green crack, right? The fight on death. I think this sort of engine really is what really cranks up the damage output, is that you can outmaneuver it potentially. Like I know there's run and charge systems in there with Scragrot. And even with Scragrot points increases, it's great to see him in there. I think he's a really, really supportive.
He's still brilliant at 210.
He is, right? I mean, 24 inches, 3 up cast. It's just ridiculous. But what it means is that when those squig herd go in, when those hoppers go in, not only do they trade out, but the final death means that they're always winning. They're always out training, especially with the cycling mechanic. Like that's really the strength. Is and so if your opponent has a way to interact with the green crack, which is incredibly hard to do with the pass off wounds, like it's just, you know, positioning is going to be key for him to get all these buffs and layers off. But obviously Joel Graham being the player that he is, I think we'll have that.
There's a lot of issues for a newer player instantly as well, like the spore splatters block line of sight. You put him in front of Scraggy, well then he can't do a spell out of it because you need line of sight. Like green crack is like, it's not wholly within, it's just within 3. So you can tail back a whole unit to get the fight on death a lot of the buffs, depending on what they are, a lot of them just a roll of one dice, like with the sneaky snufflers. And then if you roll that six, well, there's more attacks.
Yes.
And you get the jaws and walk for more attacks, and sixes are doing mortal wounds to hit. Like, it's just, there's so much damage and so much output, it's ridiculous. And then you, on your turn, you send them in, you kill that unit. They can't even send anything into you because they're going to lose it on their turn because of Gringrak.
Yes.
Like, it's...
My favorite thing about Gitz is the fact that it enables such high skill expression. It's one of those armies that if you know what you're doing, you know your war scrolls, you know how to play the army, it has such a high skill ceiling that it enables players like Joel to demonstrate just how strong of an opponent he can be and how knowledgeable he can be and make those clutch plays with particular pivot points. I don't want to say everything that the list does, because obviously things like Levitate stuff come into play, but it's just such a strong army for someone like him and his player ability to lean into. And I think he's going to do exceptionally well.
That is the first matchup for the day for us. Second one, we've got Dave Kerr and Jared Baker.
Yeah, Dave Kerr on the Lumineth and Mr. Baker on the Daughters of Cain.
Elf v. Elf.
Yeah. So how do you feel these two are going to go against each other?
So they're both Jared's a protege of Joel's. So he's picked up the aggressive nature from Joel and is also an aggressive player himself. So being able to throw around big ladies and just sort of put them in your face if need be, depending on, well, obviously in today because we can see the matchup straight away. It's hard because I have not played against the new Lumineth or know what their output is a whole lot. But being able to obviously put on three wounds onto Marathi very easily with the bows and stuff like that. Like, Jared's definitely going to play cautious in terms of movement and positioning. But if he's able to do that well, he can push through a little bit. But it's hard to sort of tell.
Yeah. I do have to make an apology. I got, in my mind, Terrence and Jared confused. So when I was speaking about Terrence before, I was actually mentioning in my mind that it was actually supposed to be Jared. So yeah, like you're saying, Jared's the disciple of Joel Graham. So the interesting factor is obviously force projection with the 15 Bloodstalkers with their threat range of 24 inches plus their move, competing against the 24 inches and their move of the Sentinel. But obviously Dave with Techless means that he has the threat range advantage with being able to teleport the Sentinels, something that he's probably not looking or wanting to do considering his Grand Strap being Defend What's Ours. But it is that option for him to reach out and touch Jared Baker's units. But at the same time, 15 Bloodstalkers is 30 wounds with a 6-up ward. But not just that, he has the 4-up rally. So the 4-up rally on that Zealous Orator with the Hag Queen, obviously being a GC, Dave not having access to the sharpshooters means he doesn't have a way to engage with removing the rally outside of spells and things like that. So it's something to be considered of with his list. Obviously, with the Griff Feather Charm on the Orator means that he's got the 5-up ward, so a little bit more robust to remove. So I think that's going to be a key piece in this matchup, is that tension that's going to be existing is okay, Dave needs to remove those Bloodstalkers being such a credible threat and obviously still contribute 3 wins to Marathi. But at the same time, Jared has those pieces where he's able to recur those losses and continue to potentially out attrition Dave, but Dave has a 5-up ward on his Sentinel, so vice versa. It's going to be a really interesting matchup. I'm very keen to see how this all goes.
We'll crack into the list then. I suppose we can start with Jared because I've already got him up on my screen. I did notice one thing. So they're both one drop. However, Dave's points were 19-10.
Yeah. So a particular point about the points is that I think the lists were made and the points are down because in the War Scroll Maker, when they submit the lists, their Battle Scroll points weren't there yet. So, Sentinels are pointed at 150.
He's not vying for that strategy. Yeah. that triumph really hard.
So, Dave's not actually at 19-10 going for an indomitable strat. It's just because the points have not been updated.
Okay. So, Jared's got a very sort of standard Daughters of Cain list. Xantha Kai, so he has got the Fight on Death Snakes with Take What's Theirs and Indomitable for the triumph.
noticeably, he only has 1 unit of heart renders, which means he loses out on that almost guaranteed battle tactic where you drop down 2 heart renders and they shoot and they move on to objective. So annoying. But does he need that? I don't know. It's nice to have those unit that unit as a potential second screen going into aggressive armies like a Slave's Darkness army, for instance. The 2 Witch Elves, the 10 Blood Sisters are very strong, but it's the 15 Bloodstalkers combined with Marathi, which is the big talking point. And this list is probably close to optimal as far as Daughters of Cain are considered at this point right now.
Yeah, even points wise, I don't think he would have to have dropped 2 units just to get the 100 points worthwhile. Like the points just work up perfectly. Otherwise, you'd sort of miss out on a little bit. And Daughters of Cain are generally quite a thin sort of army when you're running not the Witch Elf spam.
Yes, and taking that Sacrament of Blood prayer with the Hag Queen means that he's really looking to juice up Marathi. Turn 1 to give her the +1 to charge, so enabling that potential move 14 +1 to charge. So in those 18-inch deployments, he can take advantage of that. Also, some of those corner deployments, like even the first round, like the quickly looking Jaws of Galette, there are situations, thank you to Pythagoras' theorem, that you're actually not 18 inches away, you're a little bit closer. And with that threat range of the +1 prayer, which is something you can't interact with, it just means that Marathi is something that Dave's castle definitely needs to consider. As far as pinning and denying and taking him off the primary.
I don't think there's not really a whole lot to do with Jared's list outside of what we already expect out of a list like that. It's just got good output, good defense, and then it's got the nice rally as well.
A concern for me would be the delivery mechanism for the 10 Blood Sisters. I think they're more not as a not like an alpha or like a strong reach out and touch. They're more like a beta test. So when they come into the Witch Elves dissolve, they can come through and basically reverse strike because he's opted not to go for the 3d6 charge with the I can't remember the unit, the snake hero.
Oh, but, yes. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Malusai. The run and charge. Malusai, the run and charge mechanic, basically. Yeah. So those 10 Blood Sisters may be a bit slow. Base movement 8, no bonuses to charge. Oh, bonus to charge on turn 1, I suppose. Turn 2. But yeah.
Slow for elves.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, when I'm saying it out loud, 8-inch move, +1 to charge, you know what I mean? But, you know, it is something to consider and something that players could potentially play around. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And still strong in the current meta. Like,
oh, incredibly.
Doors of Cain have been strong this whole time. So not a weak list by any means.
No, absolutely not. It'll definitely push Dave. And pivoting into Dave, he's taking Lumineth with Helon, giving his Sentinels extra attacks when opponents are within 6 inches during his shooting phase. Defend what's ours, Grand Strat, so he wants to keep his area safe with his castle and Indomitable, not with 1910, though. he's obviously taking Teclis, strong piece. He's only got the 1 GC, and so does Jared. But there's no extra scoring and stuff like that with the GCs, as far as I'm aware, with the first round. So neither of them are really at a disadvantage with that one. Phoenix Stone is basically like a Pluto Revive, and then the Tunnel Master keeps him moving around, which is great. Noticeably, with the points hike on the Teclis list, a lot of people are like, oh, yeah, Sentinel's going up by 20 points. Like, the whole list is dead. He's still got great screen opportunities, and I love the inclusion of the Life Takers in this list. So this is what I was talking to before. Like, Dave is not taking like the net list. He's taken like, you know, he's taken his own kind of like pieces here and there to try and work out what he likes. I know a lot of people like to talk about reducing some of their screens to increase their viability of getting the mortal wounds on the Sentinels by taking, oh, I'm so bad. I really should read up on these character names. The hero on the horse camel.
Oh, the no, that's the Alathar. No,
I apologize for listening. Everyone knows. Everyone's listening knows who it is. It's basically the hero that gives him a second chance at trying to proc those the sun metal weapons on the Sentinels. Because obviously, not taking the subfaction that gives +1 to cast, he's vying for that 6-up straight roll with the +1 from Teclis. So, I mean, he still only needs 5s, but there's certainly some lists in this top 16 that can kind of push him off of doing. Getting that, which is a large portion of his output, are these 40 Sentinels and ensuring they get the 5 and 6 mortal spell. I love the inclusion of Overwhelming Heat. I think it's a fantastic spell that reduces the movement and the strength of units being able to get into his lines, which is what he's trying to do, which is why I love the Life Takers. It's just this really annoying piece that can come down and just continually bully people away from him just to give him more opportunities, more turns to get value out of his Sentinels and Teclis, of course.
Yeah, with the classic spell portal with the searing white light.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And the Rune of Petrifaction, I mean, such a strong endless spell. Fantastic endless spell. Yeah, two strong meta-defining lists in their own rights, and I think it'll be great to see a clash of some elves. I hope that gets covered on the stream. I'd love to be able to see that game play out interestingly because of the threat ranges of their main hammer units. It'd be very interesting.
It's going to be a big back and forth sort of who can touch who the most.
I love a good touch.
That's those two done. So we're off to Pat Nevin and Jacob Strachan. Sorry if I'm saying your name wrong, Jacob. I'm not sure how it's said, if it's Strachan or Strachan. So we've got Pat the Magakin and Jacob with another Lumineth list.
Yeah, so Jacob taking a Lumineth list. His is different, again, from Dave's list. Still a one drop, still 81 wounds, so a bit on the lower side. And again, ignore the points for his Triumph bid because of the points update. He's opting more to go for like 30 Sentinels. We'll get into, I should probably Reback, but the 31 single block of 30 Sentinels, which is an interesting pick, versus Pat Nevin's Alpha Bunker Nurgleist, which I think is really cool and different, which I like.
With both of them, we suppose we'll just go back onto the Lumineth again to go back to back Lumineth. We've got Heal on again and Defend What's Ours, classic castle grand strategy, and Not Sure on the Triumph there, and then a very similar but also different Lumineth list.
Yeah, I think the main point is that he's gone for the Ballista instead of the pivot point into those life takers. He's opted for 30 Sentinels in a single block. He doesn't have the wind charges, so losing a bit of mobility with the inclusion of the two Wardens. What I do like is the inclusion of the Calligrave. So the Calligrave's quite an interesting piece. It's got a Ethereal Blessing on there, which is nice. But it's got this Erasure spell. Are you across what the Calligrave does?
No, I'm not. Is that the new character?
No, that's the Lore Seeker. So the Calligrave, so what it does, it casts a spell. I don't know what it's cast on, maybe like a 6, but it's 24 inches and it marks a unit. So it could be a GC that's hiding, you know, that you can't kind of shoot because he doesn't have access to sharpshooters. So the Calligrave marks you, and then next hero phase, he does it again, and if he targets a unit that has been marked by Erasure, for instance, they take 2d6 mortal wounds.
Oh, wow, okay. So yeah. It's like a hero sniper.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. He also has another inbuilt war scroll ability to do with like pluses to cast and stuff like based on the turn roll. Again, it's one of those things where it's like you essentially do it on turn two or turn three for a two up or a three up plus one to cast sort of thing, which is great. But the Erasure inclusion, I think, is really good pressure tool into some of these GC like defining missions and matchups. So I really, really like the inclusion of that, considering that he doesn't have sharpshooters just to interact with opponent's GCs. I love that inclusion.
It's a slightly different take, which is nice, that it's not like they're both not the same sort of cookie cutter list. They've got their own little things. Like you very rarely see the ballistas as well.
Yeah, I often find when people say like, oh, it's just the metal, like it's just Lumineth with tech lists and some bows, I'll move on. But I think it's really important to consider like their own little flavor, the 25% that goes into the list at the end, like your own little cookie 20-25% of a list. I think that typically helps define what they're trying to achieve. Yes, obviously it's a castle list with tech list with the flexibility for all the spells, et cetera, et cetera. But I love the inclusion of the Ballista for the reduce plus one to hit and extra damage against monsters. I love the inclusion of the Erasure. I'm a bit pensive about having one brick of Sentinels. It means you've only got one crack at the sun metal weapons. So if you don't hit that, it's a bad time. And in the mirror, it means that Teclis has that opportunity to potentially just turn it off with his auto-unbind. So, you know, there is that to consider.
You've also got the issue of you might just simply overkill something drastically, and then you haven't got the chance. If you're 220s, you can throw the 120 in, or I've got a few wounds left, so I have to throw the other 20 in, or you've just overkilled it with a 30 block and you have no chance to shoot something else. With the 20 blocks, you've got two opportunities to shoot two different targets if need be as well.
Also true. It also does mean that the teleport shoot potential of this list with tech lists is a stronger output position because he gets 30 Sentinels out of it rather than 20. So there is that to consider as well.
And he's going into Pat Nevin's Nurgle list, which has a lot of words that I've not seen before on a list.
Which is great. I love it. I love it. Well done, Pat. It's fantastic. Whenever I read a list and I have to go, I have to go read the bloody Wikipedia, I feel great because it means I'm learning something new. So Magakin and Nurgle, droning guard. So what this means is that all the drones are minus one to hit turn one or the turn.
Already disgusting.
Yeah. You can already see where this is going. So all the drones, plague drones, a minus one to hit the turn they come down and set up, or turn one. So whichever that happens. Blessed Desecration is basically when the game starts after deployment, he picks a terrain piece on the table that's either wholly within opponent's territory, or if there is none, he picks any terrain piece, and he just has to hold it at the by the end of the turn. And with the options that he has, it's quite easy to do. I want to highlight that his Triumph is bloodthirsty and he's at 1945. This should already signal what his game is.
He doesn't get to pick the turn order though, but
No,
he
no.
punish you for it if you pick wrong.
Yeah, so four drops, 132 wounds, and obviously this is all covered by five up wards. So 132 wounds is not accurate. It's more like 160 plus sort of thing because of the ward. But just really quickly, he's got the classic Lord of Afflictions combo with overpower extension and Splitter Helm, which is fantastic. Turn off like command abilities and things, Inspiring Presence, Rally, etc. He's got Demon's Brew, which is a great like beat stick. I'll get to Sloppity in a minute. The Demon Prince, so turns off wards.
That's how
Fantastic.
the new Demon Prince works in Nurgle then.
Yes. So it turns off the wards and has Arcane Tome, so he has opportunity to cast Mystic Shield, for instance. Six Plague Drones, three Plague Drones, 10 Plague Bearers. And then he's got it's so funny because when you see lists and players from very particular areas in Australia, you tend to pick up on things like, oh, in this meta or this sort of zone, they really value these particular units. So you can tell that he runs into Joel McGrath quite a bit because he's included a Cockatrice and a Chaos Gargant. So yeah, Cockatrice, very strong control option. And because obviously they move quite quick with 12 inches, they can run and then they can just pick a unit within six. It's not even a shooting attack, so it's really good. And then force them to do sixes, only sixes to hit, and the Chaos Gargant for extra rend. So what this list wants to do is the Lord of Afflictions, when he deploys, he has the opportunity. He doesn't have to do this, but he can obviously pick up the drones, both units, two units, and null deploy them. And he can drop them whenever he wants with his Bloodthirsty Triumph. And basically, he can drop down and throw the charges out with rerolls and basically pin people down with these plague drones, which have so many wounds, minuses to hit, heaps and heaps of attacks on their profiles. And then you take something like a sloppy Bile Piper who has Tunnel Master. So in the past, these types of lists kind of suffered from not having support pieces like Sloppity be able to keep up. But now with Tunnel Master, he's able to come through support and throw out whatever he needs, like extra mortal, like mortal wounds on his rolls to hit and wound or whatever it is, or you can't pile in. Like there's lots of little tech pieces around there. The Slaves of Darkness being prints to turn off wards with lots of attacks. The Cockatrice for when the slap back comes through with a beta chop, turning you into sixes to hit, Chaos Gargant to give extra rend. Like there's so many great tech pieces that he just needs to utilize them in the right manner to kind of put forward his game plan. I think it's a really, really cool collection of toolkit pieces that when he utilizes them correctly, can perform really, really well.
And I think the biggest thing that's going for him as well is someone that knows the game really well and knows a lot about a lot of lists. You still had to look up everything on Wikipedia of what it was all doing. You've had the opportunity to research a lot more than probably someone that's coming into this for the first time, and they're going to be very overwhelmed by what all it can do.
Yes, absolutely. I think there's just so many pieces that he can utilize against. Like he goes, oh, I'm playing against this large like anvil with a lot of really strong ward. Well, Chaos Demon Prince. Oh, I'm playing against this thing that has really strong attacks but only as big bases. Cool, no pile in. Like there's just so many cool little tech flex pieces. I just love it. It's fantastic.
It's nice to see something a bit different on the table and not just plague drone spam.
Yeah. The Magikin dudes, whatever they're called, the Maggot Lords.
Oh yes, yeah, that's those two going there. So we'll go on to the next matchup. We've got Kron, Alexander Kron, and Terence Vola. Terence is running a Slaves to Darkness list, and Kron is running, I believe it is. Yeah, it's his KO. His classic KO.
Yeah, he's running OG KO.
Oh yes, they don't have the new book. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so I think Gabe was in conversation with him about the KO situation. And then because obviously the updates happened, the FAQs for KO were kind of like removal, hard to find basically. And so I think to get Kron in with KO, he actually had a copy of them and was able to give them to Gabe. So he was eligible to take OG KO, which is fantastic because I know he loves KO.
We'll start off with Terence first with the Slaves to Darkness. Oh, sorry. How do you think about the matchup with the shooting and the high armor Sace of Darkness matchup?
Yeah, so considering that it's old KO, like, and looking at his list with what he's trying to achieve, the Slaves list is going to be incredibly aggressive with a huge amount of mobility and the opportunity to just engage with the opponent on their terms and literally lift units. And I think the big difference I found between new KO and old KO is the survivability that between them. So old KO, the ships have a 4-up save. There's not really any ward saves in the list. They don't have a 4-up rally. You know, there's things like this happening. And so the old KO have the concern that they, when things get into them, they can lift those pieces off. While the new KO is very, very survivable. 3-up saves, access to wards, 4-up rally, like things like this to keep them on the table. And a lot of their like shifty employed deploy off boats. But that's enough about new KO. God damn, new KO. Gives me nightmares. So I think the agency lies with the Slaves to Darkness player. And it's just not if the roles go there, but if Kron needs to be aware that the threat range of these Vanguard and these Chaos Knights is extremely big. And he needs to be aware of this when it comes to deployment and who's going first. So Kron is very low. He's five.
Tops as well.
And then I think...
Kurz is one.
Kurz is one, yeah. Yeah.
So you've got this hard, very fast moving, can do a lot of damage if need be army going and getting to pick the turn order into a not so survivable KO army.
Yeah, so I think there'll be this tension between the two players where Kron, if he deploys too conservatively, Terrence has the option to just give him the turn, and then, you know, obviously they have the mobility and stuff like that. But if he plays too aggressively, then Terrence has the opportunity to get in there. So, and being Jaws of Galette, it is quite a wide or disparate, like, very far away from each other deployment, so you don't have to be super close. And again, it's one of those missions where you don't have to come to a singular point like the center. There are five objectives available, so you can max score without engaging with your opponent too much.
What do you think of the matchup? I think, to me personally, looking at both lists, I feel like Slays has all the agency and has the opportunity to really take advantage of everything that's going for them with the speed and movement.
Agreed. Being Knights of the Throne with run and charge, access to 3d6 charge spell once per game, levitate plus the 5-up rally on his Vanguard units. And then even his Chaos Knights have a 4-up ward against shooting attacks. I mean, man, oh man, it's going to be an uphill battle for poor Kron.
He's got some lovely deck chi units being those iron golems that are hard to shift themselves. So.
Yeah, and aren't they fantastic at doing that?
Yeah. Well, we'll start off with Terrence List, seeing as we're speaking about it so much then. So Slaves of Darkness, Knights of the Empty Throne, Defend What Ours, and Indomitable.
And he has Indomitable with 1990, so unlikely to hit that, but he does have the one drop, which is going to be huge.
It's a very sort of run-of-the-mill Vanguard list. I don't think there's anything too crazy about it.
Yeah, so he's got 6, 6, and 3, so 15 in total in 3 units. They all have Fell Spears, they all have Mark of Khorne, basically meaning that they're all looking to utilize that run-and-charge mechanic to get the charge, fight where they want to fight, utilize the 5-up rally to compensate for any losses that they come before they go in. And obviously they have, you know, pile in twice, once per game. So when they go into the Ironclad, when they go into a big threat piece, they can fight twice. And it's not even at the end. They just fight the second time that you pick something, right? You do have to be within 3 inches, of course, but 4 attacks each on those Fell Spears. It's 24 attacks. You can get them twos and twos so comfortably because they get plus one to wound and rend on the charge, 2 damage, like rend 3, 2 damage. Wow. Those they're going to lift key pieces comfortably.
I suppose that's really all there is to that sort of list. It's quite an easy list to pass through.
There are some like nice niche little tech plays, I will say, about the Chaos Knights. I won't go into too deep because I don't want to reveal everything, as well as the Chaos Sorcerer Lord utilizing that Chaos Familiar. I'll leave that alone, but there's some really cool tech inside the list, and I'm keen to see Terrence utilize that.
And then over to Kron in his KO list. So he's in Barak Zilfin. Spend shares to make shares. This is his grand strategy, and his triumphs blow the magazine.
Yeah, so I tried looking up some of these old grand strats and triumphs and things like that, but because the books and stuff like that, like I didn't actually have the book, of course, Wahapiti is available and stuff. So I wasn't too sure what the Grand Strat and the Triumph was, but being like book-based ones, I'm sure they're quite manageable to achieve. His list is mainly prioritized around the fact that he's got the double ironclad, one with the buoyancy aid, so he can fill that up with a whole bunch of his Arcanaut company and his heroes. But it's really just about utilizing that double ironclad. The ironclad back in the old KO book was just like such a strong piece that the double ironclad efficiency as far as points for output was just the option. And of course, it's all about that purple sun in the bottle. Like,
And then he's also got the flare pistol to sort of double down on it as
yeah,
well.
exactly. The flare pistol. So these are all pieces that we've seen before. We've all been, you know, I'm sure everyone at this point's been hurt by, you know, the flare pistol with everything doing rerolls and purple sun with the extra rend. Like, it's when it has its big go turn. And then it, basically, I think what it comes down to is can Kron do enough with his go turn into the slaves list? He has the spell ignore on his knights, as well as a 4-up ward against shooting. Farragut have the 5-up rally. He doesn't really have combat pieces.
I suppose the staff's the half move one, isn't it?
The staff is the half wound one, yeah.
Whereas Terence has one good hitting unit, but he's also got multiple other good hitting units, so it's hard to just lock down one.
Yeah, there's a large amount of threat saturation in his list, which is why it's so strong, because the delivery method is so potent and has multiple things to consider. So when Kron comes down and invests his big go turn into one particular unit, he needs to remove it, and then he has to consider all the other threats as well. So it's hard. It's hard.
Which is hard where you take a KO army when you need certain matchups to really shine the whole army. Whereas you get these bad ones and you can just see sort of on from the onset that it's going to be a tough battle.
Yeah, I've always said that KO, both old and new, is an army that lives and dies by the double turn. Like, being a shooting army, not having too much combat, it really does operate its best when it has the double turn. Some armies don't need it, but KO needs it.
And being the five drop, he never really gets to choose at the start. It's sort of based on the dice rolls later on in the game.
Yeah. So I think he'll be playing around that with that idea in mind that, like, okay, I have to deploy and really consider when is my go turn going to happen? When can I push for the double turn? He does have the two admirals allowing him to have opportunities to turn off wards, but I'm fairly confident with the old admiral rules, I can't remember, that it only turns off wards for units that are on foot, not the ships. I
Not
can't
sure.
really remember, but I might be wrong. It shouldn't be a thing that comes up in the matchup anyway.
Oh, there's that matchup done anyway. I don't think there's really a whole lot extra. Like, it's just a high output shooting army coming into something that's got a ton of saves. So
Agreed.
it's going to be, it's going to be rough. The next one seems quite exciting, though. We've got Wayne Buck and Bob Van Emmerich. So we've got Soulblight and Skaven.
Yeah, awesome. I love to see, like, not mid-tier armies, but, you know, like the non-S tier armies kind of clashing together. I think that's really exciting when you get like these armies that don't have these auto flex capability of being able to like carry their players. Like, they really have to like grind out their wins. So I'm very excited to see this game.
Yes. So we got Wayne Buck with his Skaven, which is more. He's got Warp Lightning Cannons. So, like, nice long range shooting with some Sensor Bearers and Clan Rats. Thankwell, naturally. And coming into Bob with a very a hero heavy sort of Soulblight list with a few bit of spam units, but it's sort of pick and choose where you want to go. So, I think it's going to come down to because they're both. So you've got a 10 drop versus a 5 drop. So, yeah, I don't know. I think this game could go either way depending on what the Warp Lightning Cannons roll to take off those Soulblight heroes early on.
Yeah, agreed. Like, I think you hit the nail on the head when it comes to where the pressure is coming from as far as Bob's perspective is like those cannons, it's really like the dice rolls on those cannons are going to be huge, as well as the potential threat range, because obviously Bob doesn't have any shooting to really stretch out and touch. So he's really relying on things like the 9-inch charge with the graveguard, as well as, you know, potentially getting his spell off with Neferata. And we'll talk a bit more about that. He does have Radikar with the run and charge, but you know, there is stand and shoot with those bloody las cannons, so there is that to consider. So I think he needs to find a way or effectively utilize his tools to manage those cannons and get them offline as soon as possible. Because if he doesn't, I think they're just going to pick him off.
It's not a clear-cut winner out of either of these two opponents. Like, I don't think it's going to lean either way because you've got the ability to lock down those lightning cannons with the 9-inch charges if you can get to them, if they don't sort of spread out the screens enough with the clan rats and stuff like that. But then outside of the winding cannons and the sensor bearers, there's not a whole lot of damage coming out because there is no double death frenzy.
Yeah, so he's only got the Death Frenzy coming from the Warbringer. The Warbringer is a good little beast in its own right. And I love the inclusion of the Warpstone Charm with Claw Lord. If you don't know what it is, have a read. It's very cool and very techy. Again, he's opting to go for Leadership of the Alpha, which is great for his big go turn with his Sensor Bearers along with his Warbringer. Something I found interesting was that I like the other list in the sense that it has the three Claw Lord steps ahead to, switch on the 10 Plague Sensor Bearers with the Warpgrinder. But Wayne has decided to forego that option and lean more into the sky option with the warp lightning cannons.
Yeah, I don't see a clear cut winner either way with this one, so we might as well just crack into the lists.
Yes.
So we can go in with Skaven here first. So no allegiance type is just Skaven because of the way their whole setup works. But he's got Take What's Theirs and Inspired. He's definitely not getting it at 2K, that's for sure, that Triumph. Whereas Bob will probably pull up his. I think there's maybe a little bit of a points change on Bob's list because he's currently sitting at 1930.
Yeah, I'm not sure if there was any points value changes for Soulblight,
So maybe
but
he's just going for a heavy.
yeah, I think the Bloodthirsty is there particular for the Graveguard. So and I think that's a great shout.
And the additional enhancements, it's just got Aspect of the Champion. So I don't think he's going for the double triumph bit. So I'm not sure why it would be quite so low points wise.
Maybe he just felt like the redundancy of picking up other units with the composition that he had wasn't relevant, and so having that
That's
extra
true.
charge, doesn't mind, it doesn't hurt too bad.
So we'll go back to the Skaven list there. So overall, I don't see anything too crazy or interesting. We've got the standard Thancor with four Warpfire projectors, so he will pull off any of those skeletons or zombies pretty easily from Bob's list. And then the min battle line with Clan Rats and a bit of shooting from the Warp Winding Cannon. And he's also got Vermintide as well in his list.
Yeah, so some great pieces that we've seen from the other Skaven lists. I don't like it when you're the second or third Skaven. It's like, yeah, it's the same as the other one. So I do want to sing out the praises where I can. But the Vermintide Warp Lightning Vortex are great pieces to include. We talked about the cannons; they're fantastic. Sensor Bearers with the Warp Grind, of course. And then yeah, I think the only real big rotation is pivot away is the Claw Lord with the Warpstone Charm and the Engineer to just support the cannons, basically. Otherwise, they're very similar.
There's no Skaven doesn't seem to really have a whole lot of tech. Like they're all pretty much sort of pairs. There's nothing too like sort of behind the scenes that you can't sort of pass out straight away looking at the list, which is unfortunate for the whole sort of Skaven write-up in general. There's no sort of super techie stuff. It's all pretty plain to see.
Yeah, it's a traditional like power pairs, support pieces, like kind of thing, which is nice. And I love the fact that Skaven's not one of those armies that's bogged down by the need to spam this one efficient war scroll. It does look like a proper army on the table, so that's nice.
Oh, and then it's also good because it's going into the same thing with Soulblight. Soulblight's very much with the old book. You can see it all on the paper there. There's nothing too crazy. Lots of power pairs, and it's just straight, easy to pass through.
Now, this is a moment, a rare moment, where I feel like I have to disagree with you.
Okay.
Bob's list is actually has these little niche little opportunities for some super secret saucy tech, which I love. And I think that might be because I can see it better because I've played Soulblight quite a bit. But man, oh man, there's some cool stuff in here that I really like. I won't mention everything, but some shout outs. So the Vampire Lord on foot with the flaming weapon and the marshal, it's he's probably going to be going in considering he's going for an extra attack. Two attacks with Tunnel Master. Combined with Nephi and the artifact gets him on a 2+ save that's unrendable. So a really strong pinning option to up unrendable save on the Vampire Lord, who can still hit with the flaming weapon, but he's mainly there, I think, in combination with the Grave Guard to give extra attacks along with Radikar. So he can kind of set up these really strong go turns for some units. So whether it be the 20 Grave Guard or the 40 Deadwalker zombies with a 9-inch pile in with fly. Yeah, 9-inch pile in fly. So his command trait allows units to pile in an extra 3 inches. And so when those zombies run and move and they're eligible to charge within to pile in with a 6, they can pile in 9 with fly with two extra attacks from Radikar and the Vampire Lord. doing mortals and adding more zombies to them. Like, it's just, there's this really cool, awesome, interesting layers within the list that I really, really like.
Yeah, I suppose I sort of didn't see that sort of reading over it all. It looks, I've not read over, so that he's got a very unique, with the Legion of Blood, he's got more unique artifacts, like the soulbound garments you very rarely see. With also he's got the expertise on there as well, with one being arcane and one being martial, slightly a bit different as well. Like most vampire lords are just sort of more sit at the back and they're like just your little buff piece, especially being your general, but being able to have, I suppose, that techie one, being able to send them up if need be, is quite nice.
Yeah, so Tunnel Master with the Bloodthirsty with the reroll plus that turn to a 20 Graveguard come out of the ground. I think that's where his decision making was around with that. I love the inclusion of the Mortis Engine. I think I played him at CanCon when he had a Mortis Engine there. I was actually quite impressed with the output it does and the threat, like the fact that it has some Mortal Wound chip damage. But the fact it includes a plus one to cast for Neferata as well as the other Vampire Lords is fantastic. I really like that inclusion as well.
Because the Mortis engine has a little bit of tech with its shooting profile and all its buffs as well. Because I know you were quite a fan of that one.
Oh no, I think you're thinking of the Coven Throne.
Oh, you know, I am thinking of the Coven Throne, yeah.
Yeah, so I went with a non-Legion of Blood version without Nephi, and I just did the Coven Throne for the two up. Oh, sorry, the zero up Blood Knights. Yeah, zero up Blood Knights are fun.
think, yeah. I don't see a clear cut win out of either of these two. It definitely comes down to skill expression and how they can both navigate around each other's big threats.
Which is fantastic, right? There's no list that's sitting there going, oh, this is just going to win because it's S tier or anything like that. They're great, two solid lists with great opportunities and tech inside them. And it's just going to come down to, like you said, generalship and utilizing those pieces in the right time. Yeah, this would be another game I'd be really interested to see the outcome of just because there's no like, rock, beat, scissors kind of deal. You know what I mean? So it'll be interesting to see how Bob decides to handle those cannons. I think that's the main point or tension that's going to happen in this game.
Yes, yeah, that's fair. Off to the next one. We've got Matt Terrell and Sam Sims Bailey. We've got a Sylvaneth and Nighthaunt matchup. So lots of movement going on here.
Yeah, so Tyrell being like the man oh man he is with Nighthaunt, very, very across. And then Sam being more of a Tzeentch player and only getting those three tournament entries in with his Sylvaneth. It's a battle between those two people. I'd be interesting to see how across his army Sam is. I know he plays 40K and some other systems. So Tyrell's been playing Death for as long as I can remember, you know, as long as anyone can remember. So he knows what his stuff does like the back of his hand. So curious to see what happens in this matchup as far as Sam's knowledge of his list.
It's going to be very interesting, but I wanted to just point out, looking at Matt's list, he's got the wonderful Kritsa as an ally in his list. I don't think I've ever seen Kritsa in any list ever.
Yeah. I will talk about the inclusion of Kritza and what I think he's trying to do with it. But to note, Matt is 11 drops with 1990, and Sam,
2K with 6 drops.
6 drops. So Sam's going to have the choice. Yeah. So looking at the list, how do you think they vie up to each other? How do you think they're going to go into each other?
So you've got a lot of the tree teleporting going on there, but I think with the Nighthaunt, you can just lock it all down easy enough. Sort of removes a lot of it because he's got what the one tree lord, and a bit of extra charge with the battle mage for his. Oh, he hasn't got a Durthu.
No Durthu.
Yeah, I don't see. I haven't deep dived on some of these lists. Looking over it, like I think there's not a whole lot of hammers coming out of Sam's list besides maybe Dratra as well. So I don't think the Revenants don't do a whole ton of damage, and there's no Kurnoths either. So I'm not sure where a lot of the damage is coming from on the Sylvaneth side.
Yeah, look, I'm not much of a tree man myself. Like, I typically see either tree spam as far as like tree lords recently, or it's like Kurnoth hunters, or it's like a Durthu, or even like earlier days with Inclinations was the Alarial with the strike and fade style, and you just buff her up. But I think what Sam's trying to do is really leverage that tree song, war song, war mortal wound bomb alongside things like the Spite Revenants, who get lots of attacks with access to mortals, along with Dratra for lots of mortals. But I think,
Do you think the cogs there is for the movement or for the spells?
well, I think he has the flexibility to do both. You know what I mean? So I think at first it'll be to ensure that his spells are doing well. He's hitting those big numbers with the spell bomb. And like you have to consider the matchup as well. So having flexibility is quite good. I mean, he's got a lot of redundancy into buffing up his delivery mechanism. So the Battle Mage for plus two, the Spite Swarm for an extra bonuses, and then potentially even the Cogs for rerolls. So, which is great. It means that he can utilize those units that he wants to go in when they go in. I think the Revenants, I don't see where the layers are because, again, I'm not super across the tree. So I'd be great to have, I'd love to sit down and have a conversation with him about his thoughts around the list and what he's trying to achieve. But I know 15 Spite Revs that are in the Gelation Veterans, so they can fight in two ranks comfortably. So they only have to get six or seven at the front with their one inch reach. They're doing a lot of attacks with the access to mortals. I think it's either sixes to hit or wound. Can't remember. But yeah, it's a lot of attacks, which is exactly what Nihon don't want. They want high quality attacks, low numbers with high rend. So you're investing into that rend. And I think Spite Revs are either only rend, no rend or rend one. So with lots of attacks, which is exactly what Nihon don't want.
And all damage one, so the spirit, the Krulgast Cruciator doesn't do a whole lot.
Exactly. And I think the other thing to consider is that the Mortal Wound Bomb coming from the Warsong Remnant is incredibly potent in this matchup because Mats won't go any of his spell ignores with the Banshees. But not just that, but Nighthawk can't use the plus one to their ward save in the hero phase. So they're going to be sitting on six up wards. He's going to be relying on that, the hero pass off, the protection, the, oh my God, I play Nighthawk.
Bodyguard.
Bodyguard, thank you, thank you, thank you. Yeah, to keep his heroes alive, which are going to be key. But just like the Teclis thing, he's going to be hitting multiple units. So.
Especially since you've sort of got to castle up a little bit with Nighthaunt at the start to get all your buffs in range before you can send them all off. So the the bomb's just gonna hit a lot of units.
I know with the list submission, there were some issues around legitimacy. So, for instance, I know the Acorn is on the Arch Revenant, which it's not allowed to be. I know that the Battle Mage didn't pick which realm it's from, et cetera, et cetera. So, I think that's all been cleaned up with Gabe as well as Matt, just to make sure it's nice and clean and we all know what's going on there. So, to be legit, but not to dive into too much, I assume that he's going to move the Acorn onto one of the casters because the Acorn's so important to be able to get that tree guaranteed tree up to get his Mortal Wound Bomb off working for him. So
Both inexperienced with trees.
yeah. Pivoting into the Nighthaunt list. Oh, I love this list so much.
I knew you were a bit of a Nighthaunt connoisseur there for a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, the person that got me onto it was actually Matt after playing him at CanCon. He really showed me the power of it. Because when you look at this list, before I played the actual army, I'll look at this and go, there is maybe one hammer, which is those 20 Dreadside Harridans. I don't know where any of the rest of the damage comes from, but don't be mistaken, there is so
Oh no.
damage, so much damage
When
potential.
you have no save left,
Oh.
a lot of damage comes through.
Exactly. So, material Quicksilver Dead means that any of his Harridans, he's got 40 of them, 20 and 2 10s, any of them that fight a unit that doesn't have that does have a ward save, they don't get a ward save against those attacks.
So more damage.
Yeah. So going into like Fire Slayers, Nurgle, Teclis with the 5-up ward, they just get no ward, regardless. And Dreadscythe Harridans have 4 attacks each. And he's put them, and rightfully so, in the GV battalion, just like Sam has, to ensure that he can fight in two ranks. So, you know, that's a lot of attacks. And they're base fours and fours to hit. But in reality, it is so easy to turn them into threes and threes as long as you're fighting something that's taking damage. It's so easy with things like the Terminus Nexus and things. So we'll talk about that in a minute. Just to glide through really quickly, some picks. Like I'm trying my best not to like read out the whole list. Some picks that I really like. So I'll talk about Kritzer in a minute. I know everyone wants to know about Kritzer. I love the Pendant of the Fell Wind on Cruciator is fantastic. Minus one to wound to all units within three. So fantastic. It means that he can be aggressive with him. Cruciator is a really, really strong hero with the amount of damage it does. Rend two damage, for instance. But the thing with Nighthaunt you have to consider is that, yes, the 20 Dreadscythe Harridans is a hammer and a concern. But their army, how it plays with its interaction with its allegiance abilities, these five heroes, six heroes, sorry, well, five, because Kritzer doesn't get it. five heroes, each charge they do stacks on the same unit. And so you have to stop thinking of it as like, all right, these heroes are going to fight. What he's trying to do is hit the 10-inch charge to make you fight last. And then he gets to fight with all five heroes, with all those reduced rend, with all the damage that they do. And so when you do the maths on these five heroes coming through with all those reductions and you fighting last, it's basically like this mega death ball. And even the spirit hosts, they have six attacks each, and they can get some work done when you have no save. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And then when you turn around to fight them at the end with your maybe one big monster or something, because they've just wrapped so much, you will kill one of them because he'll just make all his four ups, and then he's got his wards, and just nothing dies.
Exactly. And I think that's where the two spirit torments really come into it, is that they can revive not just summonable units, but also heroes, three wounds. And then obviously Lady Alinda has her once per game bring back units. So it's very, very formidable with this idea to grind out wins, which is great because Nighthaunt's one of those armies where it can flex into one or the other. It can sit there and stand on circles and grind out a win, or it can play really aggressive and go for those big alpha charges. Not alpha, but, you know, strong charges. The other pick I really like is the Terminus Nexus combined with this, the Midnight Tome. So once per game, he can get that out for free and you can't interact with it. So even in a techless matchup, they can't auto-unbind it. It's coming out, and it does lots of good chip mortal wound damage to turn on the Dreadscythe Harridans, as well as threaten GCs that he can't touch. But all right, let's talk about Kritzer. Okay. So Kritzer. So why he's here is, right, when, with Nighthaunt, some pieces are quite expensive, right? So 90 points is this dude who basically is just this annoying piece that he's just going to throw in, tag, and if you kill it, you know, every movement phase on a 4-up, he comes back. So kind of like a Scar Blood Tithe dude, he's just there to be annoying and to force interesting situations where he could potentially tag and make things awkward as far as pile-ins, mobility. And so he's just a great piece. It's like, oh, you can kill him. It's like, yeah, go for it. Like, I don't care. I want him to die. I want to have that flexibility, able to teleport him and move him around and threaten back points, et cetera, et cetera. And he's just access to a really easy potential battle tactics later in the game. So yeah, I think he's a great inclusion.
Okay, so I think overall with the Nighthaunt's mobility and movement, I think it's going to shut down a lot of Sam's own movement with the trees and not being able to go back through the woods or get stuck on the woods and not be able to go through them. I think Matt's probably in a stronger position overall with his Nighthaunt versus Sam's Sylvaneth.
Yeah, I think the thing that Matt has to be wary of is that mortal wound bomb and trying to shut that down, because I know he doesn't really have any bonuses to unbind, and without access to his banshees, he's going to have to rely on those spirit hosts and these two spirit torments to keep all his stuff floating and alive, which he can do. You know what I mean? He can do that. And he has the spell for, you know, give one unit 5 up ward.
If Sam can't screen enough the Nighthaunt off as well, because he's only got 10 dryads and the Wild Hunt. I suppose he's got Aetherwings as well to try and screen out. If he can get a fight last on those Spite Revenants, well, that's bad news for Sam as well.
Yeah. I think, like you said, it's just a case of who gets to pick their engagement. And I think right now, Sam has potentially, not, I wouldn't say the agency, but he has the pressure tool with that Mortal Wound Bomb to force Matt's hand. Matt also has the ability to null deploy and force like a potential 9-inch charge early to threaten. So Sam has to be aware of this with his deployment. So they both have strong tools to take each other out. It'll be interesting to see how it all goes with, you know, deployment with the mission and who gets prios and things like that. I think that'll be the key behind how the mission goes.
It's going to be a very interesting match, that's for sure.
Yes, yes.
I mean, like with all these matches, they're all going to be very interesting to see because it's all based on player skill. Like, bar maybe one matchup, they're all very much not a hammer, rock, paper, scissors sort of thing.
Yes.
They're all very sort of not either one way or the other.
Agreed.
So going on here, we've got Scott White and Nathan Thompson.
Hey, Queensland.
Hey.
No bias here.
So we've got Scott running the Zench and Nathan running Fire Slayers.
Yes, that Fire Slayers I was alluding to before. Yeah. So of all the matchups Scott to have pulled, Fire Slayers is one where it's a double-edged sword. So Scott has a very good friend, and a good friend of ours as well, is Tim. And Tim goes into store weekly with Scott. And so, but Tim mains Fire Slayers. And so Scott has played against Fire Slayers in every shape, way, or even conceivable way. So I think Scott has the knowledge and the reps about what to expect, what the opponent's army can do and what it's available to do. So he has that strength. But at the same time, it's Fire Slayers.
I looked at the list and saw one thing straight away, then I'll see an icon and I'm like, yep.
Exactly. So there is that obviously to consider. And obviously fueled by Ghoulish Rage, even the turn that he dies on a three up, he gets revived. So yeah, I think it doesn't take a genius to figure out that that Null City and Icon is a big pressure point, and what Scott can do about it is going to be the big tension point that comes to it between these two in the matchup.
And I think taking out the skill with Scott or Nathan here, looking at the list, it definitely seems like a bad matchup for Tzeentch, just with the way the Fire Slayers work and the way they ignore spells and have a lot of ward saves and everything else. So it does make it rough there. But then Scott having the knowledge later on, he knows how to get around some of the stuff, which does lead into him being in a stronger matchup there in that sense.
Yeah, so with Jaws of Galette, I think out of all the matchups, this is the one where the mission is going to potentially have the most impact on how these players can approach it. So Scott, the way with Tzeentch is like he doesn't have to kill you, table you to win the game. Like he's access to his amazing grand strat plus the amazing book strats, book tactics that he has access to. The fact that the game starts with 5 points on the map means that he doesn't really have to engage with Nathan immediately to max score, and so I think what Scott's advantage is with a disciple's army, regardless of who he's playing, is that he can just sit on the circles, disincentivize people to come into him, especially with pieces like the Kron Spine to potentially lock down scary things for at least 2 turns. Oh my God, the Kron Spine tech inside this list is so sexy. I love it. He just has access to lots of tools that he can just be like, yeah, that's cool. You can just sit there and you can hold my Kron Spine's hand, or if you want to set yourself up for a nice little like, okay, you have to come into me. It's like, well, I don't have to. You know what I mean? I can chill out here if I want to. And if I want to, then I'll go in at my pace. So Scott has that freedom. And he also has obviously that kill box of 18-inch range. And if anything comes into that, even with the Nasunian icon, it is potentially tempting fate.
And he has got the ability to sort of get his summoning engine going as well with the slow movement from the dwarf. So he's got an extra turn essentially, I think, with the slow speed of the slayers to be able to get more summoning points for himself as well.
Exactly. Scott's list is a list that he wants to take his time. Like he wants to get those summoning points every turn and get those chickens out. Just more chickens means more opportunities to snipe these particular important pieces off. But at the same time, Nathan does have tools to null deploy with his rune smiter to get the run and charge mechanic, potential like rune and things like that. So he does have options to get in, and I think Scott will have to take that consideration with his deployment.
I personally don't know which way this would go either way. What is your expectation?
Again, I think Scott has the knowledge. I think Nathan has the tech, the base, like the on paper, the Null City icon is a huge concern. But he still has to roll up 4 ups. He still has to play the mission. The mission kind of favors Scott in that way because Fire Slayers tends to wants to bunch up to keep all his buffs and ranges. So it'll be interesting to see what Nathan decides to do as far as like, okay, am I going to reach out and touch Scott early as possible, or is going to allow Scott to play the game that he wants to play. So it'll just I think Nathan has to make the decision. He has to be he's going to have to like at some point go, okay, let's go.
Yes.
You know what I
Yep.
mean?
Although Scott would love to just sit there all day sending his
Exactly.
spells into the sky.
Absolutely. If you don't engage with him, Scott's gonna win. Scott's gonna match you on points. And at some point you're gonna have to move forward into him. And if you leave it too late, it's too
The question is, does Scott have enough chickens to put on the board?
late. I know he's frantically painting as we speak.
So we'll go into the actual list then. So we've got Fire Slayers with the Vostag Lodge, Grand Strategy Master of the Forge, which I don't believe Scott has any way of turning off, which is an auto grand strat, which is lovely for the game. Everyone just loves, if you don't have a priest, you can't turn that off, with Indomitable.
Yeah, So with Vostag, it basically means that all his Volkites get plus one hit and wound on the turn they charge. So that 30 Volkites backed by those two Flame Keepers, oh boy, do they hurt if given the opportunity and access to the 4-up rally. I know it got nerfed, so at most you're bringing back five Volkites, or you're most bringing back five Hearthguard because of the 10 wound cap. It's good to keep them obviously healthy from shooting and magic. But yes, the Volkites combination with that the 4-up rally is quite nice with the Flame Keepers.
You have plenty of like sort of small, not small units, but plenty of units as well around. So you will cop a bit of damage from the spells if you can't keep them in range of the icon.
Yeah.
But even like only bringing back, you're saying five, when it's got units of 10 that still do a lot of damage, five is half a unit. So that's still a lot to be able to bring back as well.
Absolutely. The other key piece in this list is the Ash Cloud rune. So what this does is once per game, the hero phase, Nathan can just go, okay, cool, I'm gonna pop the Ash Cloud, and units wholly within 12 cannot be seen by spellcasters. So this is gonna be a quite prominent tool that Nathan will have access to in the matchup as well. So at one particular turn, he'll be able to go, yeah, cool, you can't see me. This doesn't interact with AoE spells though, because you don't have to target something. So there is that to be considered as well.
And he's even got curse for that extra little bit more damage with all those attacks.
Yeah, so the reason why it's done that the Rune Master has access to all of the priests, the spell, like not the spell lore, the priest lore, the prayer lore, prayer lore.
We'll get there in the end.
Yeah.
The universal prayer lore.
And I love the fact that he's done this because the forge gives plus one to prayers, so it enables him to have a 3-up curse. And as someone that's played a lot of Seraphon, 3-up curse is like, it's perfection, especially when you have lots and lots of attacks coming from units like Volkites. So that's also something for Scott to be, and future opponents to be aware of, is that like that 3-up curse is really, really potent.
I don't think there's much more left on Nathan's list. He does have the Infernoth for his grand strategy there as well, and that's just an annoying sort of move blocking piece because it is quite a large base.
And it potentially threatens mortal wounds that you can't engage with. Like you said, it's a prayer, it's invocation, it's just going to happen. And if he rolls doubles, I think, is it not the case? I think one of the artifacts allows him that if he rolls doubles, it moves twice as far or something like that.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, that's also really nice. He has Ember Storm to give him the runner charge, and the Forge Key. So the Rune Smiter with tunneling, he can take obviously a unit. When he comes out, he for future turns, the Forge Key allows him to have an 18-inch range for plus one to wound. So it's quite nice.
Moving on to Scott's lovely Tzeentch list. He's got Zappa's Tzeentch, Guild of Summoners for all those chickens, with the Master of Destiny. So, I mean, they've both got lovely grand strategies that neither player can interact with. So, I mean, they deserve each other there. And then he's got Inspired Triumph.
Yeah, so Scott has actually got down how many drops he is, but just quickly looking through it, it's Battle Rage Commander Trash. So he's a four drop. And then Nathan is a 10 drop. So Scott will have choice and agency as to who's going first. Master of Destiny, for those who don't know, is just literally like do your Destiny dice add up to nine at the end of the game. Oh dear, ridiculous. With the points hike, it does mean that he's had to flex in some changes with his heroes. He's dropped Pyros from what he was running, and he's now taking two Ogroids. Ogroids are fantastic units. I mean, they're quite choppy in combat. The mandatory two acolytes, and then some horrors. Horrors again. I mean, 250 points for 50 wounds with a potential 5-up ward. It's not really 50 wounds. It's more like 75 when you have a 5-up ward. So it's very, very strong. I mean, even more potentially. I have to. Okay.
And he's got that lovely sigil, so he's got even more wounds coming on the board later on
Yeah.
with those lovely chaos spawn. I hate him.
And the Cronspine is tethered to the Magister. Now, if you're not across it, the Magister, what it can do is it can basically kill itself guaranteed, utilizing Destiny dice to roll doubles, and allowing his Cronspine to enrage. And then, because it's no longer an ally, he can now chew up his own little spells to generate extra levels for itself, and then he can run a charge turn one. Like, oh boy, that is very, very scary. A level three Cronspine early out of the gates with run and charge.
And nothing you can do
And
about it
there's
either.
no interaction. So it's a very, very strong tech that's built within the list with that in mind. So very powerful.
There's a lot of everything's got artifacts, everything's got spells, everything's got aspects. Like, there's a lot of a lot of words for this list as well.
So he's one of the Ogroids with the Griffeather Charm and the Fueled by Gurus Rage, with Arcane Suggestion, is a very, very strong piece because it has a 5-up ward and it has obviously the revive back. So it's actually really, really hard to remove. So it's a really strong GC anvil that can't be ripped off on a single turn. So it's a really strong, potent unit that you can use in future missions, depending on how important GCs are. Arcane Suggestion is a great spell, but the Shield of Fate on the other Ogroid is also a really, really, really important spell. He's going to try and utilize that onto those horrors and keep them as robust as possible to sit on that really important objective for himself. So, yeah. Obviously, taking Guild of Summoners limits his ability to flex into more cheap blues and things like that to summon to sit on objectives. It's because he's pivoting into lots and lots of chickens for output, and, you know, counting as five is still good. And with the combination of the Demon Spark means that it's even easier to do so early on. He typically wants to have a chicken coming out every turn, and he can do that. You know, it's not out of this world for him to have a chicken come out every single turn.
Yeah, chickens are great. And then if you're casting spells, well, here's more fate points.
Yeah, I also cast Misty Shield. He's like, yeah, go for it.
Yeah. I mean, Fire Slayer's not doing a whole lot of casting in themselves anyway. No. They're a lot of prayers and stuff, so that is a good aspect for Nathan.
And because of that, he's going to have a hard time engaging with a list like this, as well as LRL and stuff like that, can pivot into just buffing their own units to further enhance their abilities and their roles inside their army. For instance, that Shield of Fate and other spells. So, yeah, I think, like I was saying before, it'll be up to Nathan to have an answer for Scott's game plan in this mission, this particular matchup.
Yes, I mean, it's very interesting to see. Like all matches we've said so far, they're all very interesting because they're not rock, paper, scissors, are they?
No.
They're all based on how well you can think around the problem you've got there.
I think at this level with these players, they have the capacity to go, oh, okay, you've brought scissors to my paper, but, you know, my paper tells me, informs me that if I unscrew that little screw inside your scissors, they fall apart, you know? So I think what I'm saying is that these players are highly skilled and highly informed around the game and how armies work, and I'm sure they're doing their due diligence right now as we speak around what their opponents are bringing with those lists and coming up with schemes and mechanisms to undo all their plans as best as possible, which is exciting.
And then they've also got enough time to sort of go further down the list and see, well, if this person wins, well, I've got this list to look at as well, because they're all playing in their own little brackets. There's no randomness happening. So you can pretty much, outside maybe the final, you can sort of work out the next two matches after the first one, which is quite nice to sort of be able to plan ahead that much if you've got the time.
Got the time, which I'm sure some of these players are taking the time to do so. And I don't blame them.
And our last matchup of all is Joel McGrath and Michael Clark. They've traveled all this way and they chat and play against each other quite, semi-regularly at tournaments.
Yeah, I think Michael Clark's in Geelong and Joel McGrath is in Bendigo.
Bendigo, yes, yeah.
So yeah,
Beasts.
Oh, he's taking Cruel Boys.
And Cruel Boys, that's right.
I love this
list. It's going to be a very interesting matchup.
I love this list so much. I love both his lists, actually. I really do. I think I'm a big fan of Joel and a big fan of Sir Clarkey, simply because they both pivot into really interesting armies and ideas. They both like to think they're smarter than they actually are. I don't know. But they're both very intelligent players. I will admit that. I will give them that credit where it's due. How do you think they're going to pair into each other?
I have no clue. I have not come up against much of the new Beast book, and I don't know what Clark is trying to do with it. Like, he's got so many allies from stealing from the Gits, but he's obviously sort of leaning a bit more into the shooting, but he's got Gut Rippers and stuff like that. So I don't really know how the matchup's going to go.
So Joel McGrath's list with his Bok is leaning into the Gape Spawn. So what this means is that he can take the gibbering spawns, basically units of three. And so all units within 3 inches of each of these spawns reduces their attacks by one. So this essentially is an anti-combat army. What it is. When it takes the cockatrice combined with a cron spine to pin things down, the spawn. So if you have like a unit of 20 Blade Geist Revenants, for instance, go with 3 attacks each, they now have 1 attack each. If you have like Scarbrand coming with like 8 attacks each, he now has like 1 attack because he's tagged by so many units of spawns, right? So it's an anti-combat list. cruel boys are not a combat army. So what Michael's decided to do, Clarkie, is basically take the idea, the core principle behind cruel boys, which is leveraging those really cheap and effective bolt boys and the mortal wound output that they have, and try and have as many turns and pressure your opponent with the powerful tools that they have. So things like, again, I don't want to speak too much around the tech and possibilities, but there is a lot of things here combining with the Cruel Boy's allegiance abilities, with being able to take opponent's units off, with a super sneaky command trait to teleport his own unit after deployment, combined with these 12 Bolt Boys. Now, the Bolt Boys are in G Galatian Sharpshooters, so they can pressure GCs in certain missions, which is quite good. But Mike, Clarkie's five drops to John McGrath's like many drops. So even though it says like
Yes.
nine drops, whatever, each of those spawns are a drop, right? And so what, which is good. It means that Joel gets to deploy with perfect information because he'll have max drops, and he can put one spawn in the trees and one spawn on the table. Like he has a lot of board coverage, right? But Mike, Clarkie is going to build his castle with multiple layers of screens to keep his opponent at bay and just enforce his will with these bold boys.
Well, he's even got the anti-charge mechanics with the Loon Smashers and the Stabbers.
Exactly. Yeah, with the Fennecs, absolutely. And so that, I really like this inclusion. I really, really do. Yeah, that plus the Grin and Blades. It's so interesting. So Clarkie's like kind of like an anti-shooting list with some anti-combat tech in there, but mainly he's taking Grim Blades obviously for the anti-shooting opportunity, and Joel's taking an anti-combat army. So it's interesting that they meet each other in the middle.
Yeah, they're too smarter than they should be, sort of
Yeah.
fellas. They've done themselves in,
Yeah.
haven't they?
And they're pretty much local players, right? Like you said. So
Yeah.
funny. Shall we deep dive?
Yes, I've got Joel up here for number one. So his Beast of Chaos with Gav Spawn, as we've said. Protect the Herdstone is grand strategy. It sort of speaks for itself there. And then the Inspired Triumph.
Yeah, so with the Herdstone, something I learned recently is that you don't have to actually smash it. You just have to stand next to it. And it's.
It's the same as the Gitz one as well.
Yeah. So I found that quite interesting. And because the Herdstone, like its benefits are world like board wide, I found that a lot of people were just like putting in the corner as far away from everything as possible. But I found that to be potentially a mistake just with things like teleports, tunnel masters, redeploys, things like that. And perhaps maybe it's better to keep it centrally inside your castle. Joel's list, when you look and read through it, is not a list that's going to be utilizing the null deploy as effectively as some other lists, like the Bulgors, for example, right? So he doesn't actually want to be utilizing like, I'm going to come from the sides. Ha-ha. It's more like, all right, I've got this giant crawling menagerie of spawns, and if you come into it, I'm going to reduce your effective damage exponentially. Plus the cockatrice. And the cron spine to potentially to like, you know what I mean? So it's really, really anti-combat-y sort of stuff. The Great Brave Shaman's obviously fantastic. You'd probably, I'm not sure if he wants to take both of them off the table, just one, but having one off the table, or even two, means that he can push and pull things. There's very, very few things in the game that allows you to manipulate your opponent's positioning and movement outside of their turn. And Bok has one of the best pieces for that, which is fantastic.
Out of turn movement and repositioning your opponent's models that they have there is just, it's game breaking.
It is.
Like it's massive.
It's one of those things. It's one of the reasons why I love corn so much.
Cornflakes.
Mate, I'm such a big cornflake at the moment. Absolutely. What else? I don't. So typically when you see a cron spine, in things like Cities and Zinch, they have mechanics and ways to kill the person it's bonded to enable it to rage and do some clanky things. I know the Great Brave Shaman can kind of hurt itself with its role, so perhaps that's what Joel's looking in to do, potentially.
So with just a question there with that, I know they've got to come on by turn two.
Yes.
Is a Great Brave Shaman outside of that, or do they have to come on by turn two? So it then turns wild by turn two.
No, it has to come on the table by turn two.
It has to come off. So if it's not on the table, does it kill itself, or is it has to come on?
So what he can do is he can leave it off and it dies, and so start of turn three, it's enraged.
Oh, okay.
What I'm
Yes,
saying
fair
before
enough.
is, if he's when he does the extra command, heroic command ability, like the pull or the mortal wounds and stuff, he does mortal wounds to himself. So if he rolls 5 and a 6 for the first one, and then a 3 or 4 for the next one, he kills himself, and then the cron spine's on. You know what I mean? So he has that option to flex into, which is something you typically want to see when you're building inside a cron spine in a list. Plus the Kargus, Chaos Gargant for extra rend. The Ravening Direflock. Are you across how the spell works?
No, I've seen it, and that's about it.
Yeah. So it's actually a really potent spell, and I think I would encourage everyone to kind of read up on what it does. It turns off Inspiring Presence and Rally.
Huge. Huge.
For 40 points. Yeah, it's very, very good. And the effective range. And the thing is, like, spells like this are good, but when their effective range is really strong, that's when it becomes like, oh, okay, I can turn this on, and we're go turn. So very, very strong. So yeah, super, super strong anti-combat army. I will preface, the spawn shooting is incredibly potent.
What is the spawn shooting?
So
profile?
The spawns are base move at 10.
Slow, real slow.
Yeah, with run and charge. They don't have run and shoot, but they've effective range of, like, I think it's like 18-inch threat range with 10-inch move and 8-inch range of shoot. But they rend 1-2 damage on their shots, 3-3s, d6 attacks.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's very potent. I mean, looking at it, it's just like, oh, yeah, it's whatever. But, like, when it's, like, you got 12 of them in there that can run a charge. And
12 d6.
Oh, my goodness.
It's, plus the movement.
Yeah. It's, like, you look at it and you go, well, where's the damage coming from besides the spine? Oh, it's there. And I think it's one of those armies that can really do lean into the attrition side of things. So if we run into the center circle and we both stand there, you're going to do one attack because I reduce your attacks by so much. And I'm going to do lots. And my Chaos Gargant's going to give me extra rend. The Cron Spine's going to roar you. All my Chaos Spawns have extra rend because it's like turn 4. I've waited you out for so long. So I've got rend 2 on all my attacks. Yeah. And then, of course, you know, I won't go into spells on too much, but there's some really good layering that Joel has put into to enhance his spell casting and things like that as far as output goes. So it's always great to see a list like Joel's where there's just, you're looking and go, okay, well, I don't see it straight away. And so you just dismiss it. But then when you actually play against it, you're just like, oh.
Now I'm scared.
I get it now. Yeah. And I think in a mission pack like this where a lot of the opponents would have done their research and they're reading and they're aware of it, there's no gotchas because they should, at this level, should be across what it
does. They should know anyway.
Yeah.
It's on them if they don't know
exactly.
At this point.
So I think it's really, and I know Clark, he's a well-read individual. He's across, he knows what the list does and what to expect. So I've no ill feelings with sharing all the tech behind the sort of what's potential there, you know?
Yeah. Well, speaking of Clarky, we're going to Clarky's list then. Under the Cruel Boys Allegiance with Grinning Blades, Defend What's Ours, and the Triumph is Inspired. We speak earlier on the Bolt Boys and what they can sort of put out. And he's got the lovely Hop Grot Slitters and some Gut Rippers as well, with sneaky Moon Clan Stabbers in there with the Fanatics to pop out for the anti-charge mechanics. We all know that the Swamp Caller Shamans have changed their rules a little bit, so now they can at least cast the spells as well as hand out the buffs, which is always nice to see.
Yeah, I like I was saying before, this is one of those Cruel Boys lists. I've got such a soft spot for Cruel Boys. I don't know if you do, but Cruel Boys is one of those armies that's had like one of the lowest win rates, but such an amazing collection. Like, the models have such flavor. You just kind of root for them. And I think this list is fantastic. It's one of the stronger Cruel Boys concepts or ideas. I'm not sure how well it's going to go in on the table, but I have a feeling it has the potential to do really, really well just because of what it's trying to do. And what it's trying to do is not have its inner castle or its inner lozenge, shout out to Honest Ball Gamer, to have its insides taken in so early. So in the past, people have taken like 12, 18 Bolt Boys, but have screened with like 2-man Gut Rippers, right? Because the points were so high. Now, third time lucky with these points reductions and access to Grim Blades, it means that we can now invest into these Bolt Boys and have more layers of screens to keep them safe, because the damage output, 120 points for how much damage these dudes do, is so strong with the mortal wounds. Yes, it's a bit of a slot machine, but it's very, very potent. And so I think that's what Clarky's entire strategy is deny, 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 and get value out of his Bolt Boys for as long as possible and out attrition their opponents, utilizing those pieces. So There are lots of ways that he can do that, lots, which is fantastic. He has options. I love the choking mist 24-inch spell. You pick a point, all units within, I can't remember if it's 6 or 3 inches, but multiple units now have half move. Fantastic.
Yeah, so it reduces that threat on your front lines.
Exactly. Super sneaky. He can pick a unit, any unit of his that is a cruel boy, so he can't pick his stabbers, unfortunately. But he can teleport them anywhere on the map outside nine. Anywhere. So that could be his Hopcrawler Slitters just over the corner for a really easy tactic, the terrain tactic. Or it could be his 20 gut rippers and they sit in front of you in a parking lot in front of you. So you're stuck inside and they alpha pin you. Like there's so much flexibility with these with those options. The nasty hex to turn off wards with Tunnel Master, which means he can position for the double, get the nasty hex off. And then turn off your wards, and then suddenly those bolt boys really lift up those fire slayers, for instance. So, yeah, really, really strong. And I love the inclusion of the fanatics. It's so cool that you can just release them with always strike first. You come into them. It's just a second turn of denying you getting into his inner lozenge, which I love.
They work really well for a list like this, whereas they don't work. They're fun, but they're not serving the same purpose for Gits as they are for the cool boys.
Yes, yeah.
And I think out of everyone, I mean, there's not many shooting armies, but of all armies, I think he's the only one that's taken the sharpshooters as well.
I think you might be right.
So he can sort of lay a bit of threat onto those GCs.
Yeah, so looking at these missions, we've referred to them a few times, but Jaws of Galette, there's not too much GC interaction really in there. The Presence of Idols is a classic mission. The Prize of Galette game 4, again, no GC interaction. And Ours for the Taking. Ours for the Taking is a mission where you have three objectives, and the center one, if you have a GC contesting and you own it, you get an extra point. So that's probably the only mission where GCs kind of play a part into it. And hats off to Gabe to not include all the organizers for the Masters, not to include any sort of horrendous GC inclusion thing. I think that's a great pick. But Ours for the Taking is probably the only one where the sharpshooter potentially could come into a really important point.
Well, I think even just being able to target them in general is nice.
Yeah. Oh,
A
yeah.
lot of those, yeah.
Yeah.
And he obviously didn't realize what the scenarios were
Yes.
going to be beforehand, so he's taking a bit of a guess and a bit of a gamble there as
And I
well.
think it's the right choice. I think it's the right idea. If you have access to it, why not utilize it? So.
What do you think of the match between these two here? Do you think it's just going to be sort of wild, and whoever sort of gets the upper hand on the start there sort of can push it a bit further, or what do you think between those two?
So a lot of the tools that Joel McGrath's bringing is anti-combat, like I mentioned, and Michael Clarke's offensive output really is steeping off those bolt boys. So I think Clarkey has, being a shooting army into Bok, with the many layers he has the agency. He is the one with all the not the power, but he has the one that's at the advantage, I think, looking at paper on paper, right? Both the players are very experienced. They know what to expect. And so I think priority will be pretty big in this mission, especially considering the mission. Again, it's one of those missions where Joel, like Cruel Boys, like the shooting doesn't have super huge effective range. So Joel can max score without engaging with Clarkie too much. So he doesn't have to go in super early. He can kind of draw him in and just kind of wait for either person to kind of make mistakes. So it could be in a situation for the first one or two turns, a bit of a staring contest, waiting for the other person to pull the trigger. But at some point, Joel's going to have to go into Clarkie's bubble, into his castle, because he's going to defend what's ours, and he's not going to be incentivized to come out of it. And so Joel kind of has to come up with an answer or a way to get in. And I think with the combination of Grin and Blades and turning off those spawn shooting attacks, I don't want to say Clarkie's got it, but I think he has the edge.
Okay, that's all the matchups. We're done.
All right, Aimless.
Overall, do you still want my one burning question is it still seems that the lower drops, if you can get that one drop, is still a strong advantage?
Yeah, looking at the mission pack, there's no like dire important mission that requires a GC. So I think sharpshooter is a nice to have. And I think a lot of armies, like I know, for instance, Nighthaunt and the Sam Sims list with GVs to have fight in two ranks is quite nice. But if you can have units that don't rely on that battalion to be effective in combat and push yourself into that one drop and still have really effective tools, I still think that's the best you know, spiky approach to being able to control the turn and whether or not you want to go, okay, you have the first turn, I'll play for the, and I control, not play for double. People say that a lot. It's more about controlling the double than it is playing for the double. So I think that's very, very potent and typically leads to more wins versus, let's say, taking a really nice techie anti-deployment simply because the missions that you see are very central, typically. So, sorry, it's a long way of answering. Yes, wonderful. One drops are very good.
It still seems it's never shown. If you can control what happens in the rounds from the first one or two rounds, it's still more valuable than what some of your units can do.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've had a game that goes past turn three, let's put it that way. And so those turn one, turn two is really important.
So, Corey, at the end of all of this, who's your predicting winner for the Masters season?
So it's so hard not to be biased and love your Queenslanders. So what I think is going to happen, ultimately, when you look at this, top seeds, Joel and Dave, are on opposite sides of the spectrum, right? And so the idea, looking at it numbers-wise, what you should see happen is Joel goes through and gets to the final, and then Dave kind of goes through and gets to the final. Like that's kind of the idea and why the seeding system kind of happens. Whether or not that happens because of, you know, dice and priority roles and mission and matchups, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What I think will happen is, and what I'd love to see happen, is to have Joel and Dave meet in the final. That will be game four, which will be Prize of Galette, which is the best mission in the pack, very neutral. And I think when you look at Dave versus Joel's list, just looking on paper, they have such great tools going into each other. It's so hard to pick it. My heart says Dave, but I think Joel has the edge. Yeah. He just has so many games under his belt, such a strong player, and have such a strong, competitive, dominant faction and list. It's going to be, I think, the edge is with Joel, but it's not without reach for Dave. So I wish Dave luck, and Joel, of course, as well. But it'll be a very intense game, and I'm very, very keen to see that final happen if it does. And I think that's my prediction, yeah. What's your prediction?
Look at the matches. So in terms of if Joel McGrath is able to take the win over Michael Clark, what do you think of that matchup with the Chaos Spawn against the Gits, losing all of that attack?
So How do you think
that sort of match would go? Because that's where I lean into is not the confusion, but that sticking
like,
point.
We could definitely sit down and do a whole hour spiel about like how these matchups and stuff work. So for instance, right, I think Clarkie has the advantage over Joel, but I think Joel's list is better tailored to deal with Joel Graham's list than Clarkie's list.
Yes. Yeah, that's where my one point is, I think, over all of it. Yeah.
So it's so interesting how the wheel turns as far as matchups go. So if Clark does go down, Joel gets it. Joel's a great pick as far as the list goes to deal with Joel Graham's ability. However, something to be mindful of is like how the rules interaction goes with the spawns and the extra attacks. I don't know if the extra attacks generated are not included in the characteristic. So they could be nullified in that way. But the idea being that, yes, anti-combat, Joel's list is obviously combat orientated. So, Joel's list is pretty... I think he's taken this list into consideration that Gits is a very strong piece.
Okay.
Yeah. This is assuming that Joel Graham beats Coots in the first place. So, you know, he could roll a whole bunch of 9-inch charges, get into all these, you know, his juicy pieces and take all Joel's toys off the table. We don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. My, outside of that, my prediction, like there's so many strong players and so many strong lists. Like I think, we definitely want to see at least one Queenslander, but they might knock each other out is the other issue.
Yes, I know.
It's hard. Like I'm always rooting for my boy Scott and he's number 7 as well. So that always works out well. Yeah. It's so hard to tell because there's so many strong players and so many strong lists. Look, I'm going to throw one out there. I think Matt won 1 year with his OBR, but he's now back on his Nighthaunt train and he loves his Nighthaunt and he's a strong player with Nighthaunt. And Nighthaunt has a ton of tips and tricks. So I'm just going to throw it to Matt, I think. Like, I know it's going to be a hard matchup against Joel because of all the mortal wounds anyway, but we're going to go with an outside choice and go with Matt.
All right. I see it. Nice.
Because there's also Joel's obviously played at the top end quite a bit, but Matt has already got the strength of playing at the upper echelon. Playing at end of the tournaments is always different probably to playing at the end of a Masters season. So there's going to be a lot more nerves there, and Matt's already shown that he is stronger in those nerve regions. So my pick's going to be Matt Terrell in his ninth hole.
Right. I mean, when you look at this list of names, it's hard to think of anyone that's played their faction or their army more than Matt Terrell has of Nighthaunt, right? So
yes,
he definitely has the reps under his belt.
So that's going to be my pick. But then we'll just watch everyone fall apart. It'll be someone else we weren't thinking.
Yeah, that's it. It's always the way.
Well, I think that's pretty much us for the wrap-up then. I don't think there's really much more to say other than like good luck to everyone at the tournament. We'll post all the links to everything down below. Did you have any closing thoughts though, Corey?
Other than I just want to reiterate that all these players have been extremely successful throughout the many years that this season's gone on to. And that just a huge congratulations to them. In the pack, it actually has this lovely moment if you take the time to read it. It says, at the start of the event, we're going to take the time to acknowledge all the success the players have experienced. It's not like, all right, 16 boys in and there's only going to be one winner. It's really lovely to see that we're celebrating the success of competitiveness at this level. Like, congratulations and hat off to all these gents coming in and performing so well and going to the events. And yeah, just well done. You know, acknowledge the fact that you guys have gotten to this point and you're now vying for you're in contention for the best Australian player. That's fantastic. You know, Well done.
And we'll see you all on the weekend.
Yeah, we'll see you there.
For some playful ribbing.
Yeah, absolutely. Best of luck, gents.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, we'll sign out here then. But thanks for everyone for listening in and catching up with this sort of, there's just going to be a standard episode for this one for this week, but it's just going to be released a bit earlier so people can have a listen along before the tournament starts and maybe they can get a nugget out of there somewhere they weren't sort of looking for a bit more extra information. Have a good rest of your week, Corey, and I will see you on the weekend.
See you Saturday.
See you Saturday. Catch up. Thank you for listening to Unidentified Wargamer. You can find links for the guests located in the description below. You can find the show on Twitter at @u_wargamer. And I will see you next week.